Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Pumps. These assholes, they always get away. Those were the words in that grown man's mouth as he followed in the dark a 17-year-old boy who he didn't know. And excuse my language, but those were his words, not mine.
Can't just kill a motherfucker for no reason and get away with it, shout. Gotta have some justice. Whether it's street justice or legal justice. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. In a hoodie, I can walk anywhere. Obnoxious, even though that is obvious how they freely comply. We was reaching for freedom, now we seeking out justice. Then they get away with it like they paid off the judges. Mama and daddy crying, sad that their son died. His killers on TV telling these foolish lies. Tyrannic is advertised, I vomit on genocide. They taking away precious lives, gotta cover my daughter's eyes. And visually, repeatedly, I feel like they keep beating me. It's 1957, they killing people senselessly. I see this all so vividly, I'm losing my identity. The world is in a crisis, gotta walk with he who's stricken me. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. In a hoodie, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin, I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. In a hoodie, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want. I walk the streets in my hoodie, no flexing, just cooling, packing juice and some Skittles. So why did he shoot me? It went from innocent living. Them blows were given. Don't know how he was driven to the point of no feeling. See, I don't play with folks chilling. So why you come follow me? It's self-defense. Ain't nobody harming me. Black and starving. So you call us retarded. Now we building the skills like Malcolm and Martin. We don't listen to Al Sharpton. I'ma be the starter. You talking about a circus? We do this for a purpose. The world is filled with cluttery. People speaking utterly. I'm about to bow on and don't care about who governs. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. I'm Trey Vaughn Martin. In a hoodie.
His name is Malik Zulu Shabazz. Malik Zulu Shabazz.
It is indeed my honor and great joy and privilege to be invited by brother and Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz, who is one of the greatest student leaders of all time.
I'm talking about terrorism now. We want a war on terrorism. The war on terrorism should have started 400 years ago. Bring the flag, brother. Bring the flag.
Bring the flag.
Bring. Because I'm here to tell you that false patriotism will not get you out of this. Holding a bandana flag around your head will not get you out of this. Huh? Flag on your antenna in your car will not get you out of this. You might be saying, God bless America. But when did America ever bless God? You might be saying, God bless America. But God might be damning America at this very hour.
What's all this shit I see on here about harassment and all that bullshit, rap for power? You sumbitches, get a goddamn job and make a constructive citizen out of yourself and stop all this bullshit. You wouldn't have to have no fucking rally for power. You got that message, motherfucker?
Black power. Black power, black power, black power. More black power to my people. This is your brother, soldier in arms, comrade in battle, Sean Saddam Khalid. I'm happy to be able to broadcast live once again to you from right here in the hails and smells of North America. As always, I count this a privilege. This is a joy. It is an honor to be able to talk to you from this bold radio broadcast called Black Power Radio. We welcome you out. If it's your first time listening, second time listening, or if you're a long supporter of our revolutionary radio, we appreciate you and thank you for tuning in. And we say stay tuned and stay tight, as tonight we got a bold black man on the line with us tonight, a bold black man who's crisscrossing the country, raising the spirit of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, blood relative of that great and honorable Frederick Douglass, that great abolitionist and freedom fighter. We're talking about Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. He'll be on with us tonight as we push forward to the Million Youth March 2013. We are a little less than 3 weeks away now. 3 weeks, a little less than 3 weeks away from September the 7th. September the 7th, the main mass gathering right there in Harlem, New York, or some say New York, Harlem, New York City. We're less than 3 weeks away, and if you have not got your ticket to be a part of the National Black Family Convention, which is taking place September the 5th through the 7th, the 5th through the 7th, then you make sure that you go to MillionYouthMarch2013.com. That's MillionYouthMarch2013.com, and you will see the list of the convention schedules. You'll be able to get Million Youth March apparel and wear. Most importantly, you'll be able to be in the house. You'll be able to be in the house and be there with all those great endorsers and great freedom fighters, such as the great youth prodigy, Sister Autumn Ashanti, the great recording artist, Sister Erica Badu, the National Conference of Black Mayors leader there, Sister Vanessa Williams, talking about that great freedom fighter, member and leader of the Black Power Cartel, General Sarah Sutan Seti, talking about that great PhD and warrior scholar from the Nation of Islam and the 5% Nation of Islam, or the Nation of Gods and Earths, Brother Wesley Muhammad, also known as Brother True Islam, talking about hip-hop legend, hip-hop legends and hip-hop legend, Brother Bun B, who will be in the house from the group UGK, talking about the People Survival Program and the Black Soldiers, and Brother Shaka Shakur, talking about POCC, the Prisoners of Conscience Committee, and the great revolutionary freedom fighter and son of Chairman Fred Hampton Sr., talking about Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. Also, you'll hear from my brother tonight, and you'll see him there live, Million Youth March 2013, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Of course, our national chairman, Dr. and Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz, and there's so many others. I mean, that's just a small portion of the list, but just that right there is worth your top dollar. Your top dollar, not even to mention the Leonard Jeffries, and not even to mention so many others who are taking part and who know what time it is. Queen Dolores Blakely and others, Charles Barron and others, Councilman Charles Barron, DJ Greg Street. I mean, it's power packed. It is official. It is official that the Million Youth March 2013 is going down and is happening. But it's more than a march. We're not talking about marching in a traditional sense. We're talking about a movement. And so that's why it's important when you hear men and soldiers and warriors like Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson stepping on the front lines, coming at a time when there's a vacuum in black leadership across the nation, at a time when so many have given up on black power and given up on black nationalism, given up on revolutionary pan-Africanism. It's time now to re-champion the cause. So it's an important time, and our ancestors are calling us all together. I want to remind us all that we have a national truce amongst black organizations and African organizations, and whatever our differences are one with the other, we must settle our differences, whatever the differences are, whatever they are. If they're all humanly possible, if we can settle our differences and settle the score with each other, let's settle our differences amongst ourselves. We forgive everybody, black man and black woman. We forgive everybody but ourselves. We forgive everyone who has done us wrong, including the white man who has been and woman who have been the most brutal to us, but yet we're quick to forgive them, and they don't even ask for forgiveness, but we are brutal to ourselves. It is a national truce for September the 7th, really for the rest of your lives, if possible. But most importantly, for this upcoming Million Youth March, we're settling the differences. We're going beyond political, ideological, spiritual affiliations. We're coming together as Africans. Africa for the African. We're coming together as black people here in the hills of North America. So we're excited and glad that you're with us. And we want to open this show giving thanks to the black God of our forefathers and foremothers that answers to many different names. Regardless to land, label, or language, we bear witness there is but one God. We give thanks to all of our ancestors, the great minds and architects and builders of civilization and humanity, the mathematicians and scientists and scholars of the known world. We give thanks to them and the great freedom fighters who came after us when we were captured and robbed of our names, our language, our culture, our folkway, our foreways, our norms, and the power of our own being. We give thanks to all of them, too many to name tonight on Black Power Radio, but all of our ancestors we say ashe for. We give thanks for all of the Panther regiments that came up, starting first in Africa, then going all the way down in Alabama with the Honorable Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael and Bob Brown in Lowndes County, moving on up into San Francisco, moving on up into Oakland, California, moving on across the way to New York City, and then making its way to Dallas, Texas in 1989 at the reformation of the new Black Panther Party under Aaron Michaels, later the great Black Power General, the Honorable Dr. Khalid Abdul-Muhammad, and now our National Chairman, Dr. and Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz. Black power to you all. Black power from the new Black Panther Party for self-defense. I want to take time to read our brother's bio because it's a work in progress, and I say it like that because he's still on the move. He is still adding to the resume and still adding to the credentials, but I'll just read to you some of what our brother has done now. He says that he is an educator, a psychologist, a political scientist, and a Pan-Africanist. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson is a nationally certified school psychologist who practices privately throughout Pennsylvania and lectures throughout the country. Dr. Umar is a blood relative of the great Frederick Douglass, and he is a great abolitionist and orator. As a school psychologist, Dr. Umar evaluates children from ages 3 to 21 in an effort to determine if they have educational disabilities and a need for special education services. Umar is considered a national expert on learning disabilities and their effect on black children, as well as an expert on helping schools and parents modify challenging behaviors that can ultimately lead to disruptive behavior and disorder diagnosis in black boys. The academic war against black boys is deadly. As a child therapist, Dr. Umar specializes in working with at-risk, violent, suicidal, and depressed African-American boys and girls. For 5 years, he served as the youngest of 5 African-American male school psychologists in the 5th largest public school district in America, the School District of Philadelphia. Dr. Umar has been featured on various black talk shows, college campuses, workshops, conferences, and panels in the United States and beyond. In addition to his media appearances, Umar is a highly sought-after, motivational, and informational speaker. His speaking engagements vary from workshops to expert panels throughout the country. Dr. Umar is considered an authority on the education of African-American children and mental health in the black community, from grade school to the graveyard. At that time, 37 years old, or at 37 years old, Dr. Umar Johnson is a shining beacon in the fields of black psychology and black education. Dr. Umar has presented before embassies, stadiums, museums, schools, universities, churches, correctional facilities, community centers, and international audiences. With the genealogy of Douglass and determination of Garvey, Brother Johnson's fire is unstoppable. And so, brothers and sisters, it is my honor and privilege at this time to welcome a comrade of ours and brother in the struggle and a warrior on the front lines fighting for the liberation and salvation of the black nation. We want to welcome to you right now our brother, colleague, and friend, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Black Power, sir. Welcome to the radio broadcast.
Black Power, it's an honor to be with you tonight.
So glad and so honored to have you on. Thank you for coming on and honored to be here with you. We want to touch a number of subjects tonight, but I just want to first kind of hear from you. I want you to kind of introduce yourself to the radio listening audience in case we have people who may be listening for the first time or may have, as I say, been under a rock somewhere. Who is Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson?
Sure. Dr. Umar Johnson is the foremost Pan-Africanist on the planet right now. I'm a doctor of clinical psychology, certified school psychologist, great-great-great-great-grandnephew of the greatest black leader of the 19th century, the Honorable Frederick Douglass. Our work is to fight to save our young people from the special education machine and the ADHD machine and the psychiatric medication machine. I'm author of the new book, Psychoacademic Holocaust, the Special Education and ADHD Wars Against Black Boys, which is the first book and the only book written by a black male school psychologist that teaches black people and parents in particular how the war against black boys is being carried out, but more importantly, what they can do about it. In that book, you'll get the definitions of all the so-called learning disabilities and disruptive behavior disorders. In that book, you'll get the most frequently prescribed medications for our young people, the Ritalin and the Adderall and the Strattera, and the side effects that come from those drugs, and also the amount of money that the publicly traded Wall Street drug companies are making by diagnosing our young men with ain't no daddy at home disorder, because that's all ADHD is ain't no daddy at home disorder. They took the fathers out the house and put the boys on crack for kids. In that book, you learn how to deal with disruptive behavior without medication. Your son does not need medication to receive an education. So for the past 6 months, I've been traveling the world and teaching black parents, because special education and ADHD against our young men is not just a North American thing. I'm a Pan-Africanist, and as a Pan-Africanist, I stand on the square that all of our problems we share in concert with Africans all around the world. So whether you live in Canada, whether you live in Australia, whether you live in the United Kingdom, any European-dominated geographical territory, you're going to have that great devil special ed and that great devil ADHD. As a Pan-Africanist, I'm currently working with brothers and sisters across the planet, from Bermuda to Jamaica to Canada to London, and of course all across the United States, to bring ourselves together for a great mighty conference in the motherland of Africa in July of 2014. I am a Garveyite. We just celebrated his birthday 2 days ago. And in that spirit of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, I believe that all of our problems have to be solved by an international collective and cannot be solved in the piecemeal terms. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. For all your parents out there who are listening to tonight's broadcast, if any of them have any issues with regards to their children, they're trying to kick them out of school or force them to say the Pledge of Allegiance, they want them tested, they think they're retarded or learning disabled or reading disabled or think they need special ed or medication or a discipline school, any issue as it relates to special education and regular education law and process, any of your listening parents can reach out to me for some free consultation as to how they can deal with those problems. So that's what I do. I fight, I educate, I speak, and basically I'm just trying to unite African people and, more importantly, build a Pan-African school district for our young boys and our young girls, the Frederick Douglass and Marcus Garvey Academy for the young boys and the Anna Douglass and Amy Jakes and Ashwood Academy for the young ladies, where we can teach them knowledge of self. I maintain that the American public, charter, private, and parochial school, as well as the institution of higher education, is only designed to prepare black children to work for white people. Well, those days is over. It's time for us to start preparing African children to work for themselves, not an education for servitude, but an education for global domination. We are not trying to share power, because no race on earth has ever shared power. We're trying to take power. Pan-Africanism today, tomorrow, and forever. Africa for the Africans, those at home, and those abroad.
Black power, and excellent. You said a mouthful, and the lines are lighting up already. But we want to continue on that line. Now, being a clinical child psychologist, that means that you're also in the professional field. And I want to ask you this. Now, some people have had issue trying to balance their professional lives and their revolutionary or activist lives. How have you been able to do that and share some tips with us on how to balance in this mission?
Well, I think one of the most essential things that's necessary in order to balance the political with the professional is to become economically independent. It's going to be difficult to be what I refer to as unapologetically African, which is what Mr. Garvey referred to when he talked about race first. I maintain that it's going to be difficult to be unapologetically African if you're not economically independent. The only way or the only reason that Dr. Umar Johnson is able to tell the truth as adamantly as I tell it is because I'm economically independent. I'm self-employed. If I was still working for the school district of Philadelphia, still working for some of the charter schools or working for the universities, I would not be able to speak as freely as I do. So I believe that economic independence is the prelude to political independence. Any leader or any organizer, as I like to be referred to, you know, who is serious about this work has to be economically independent, because if you're forced to choose between a roof over your family's head and food in their stomach and clothes on their back versus the condition of the masses of black people, our history has been well put before us. And many of our leaders have chosen, okay, the food and clothing and shelter of their families over and above the greater good of the race. And that is not a decision
right.
that we want anybody to have to make, to choose between your family and to choose between your racial family. You should not be asked or put in that position. But when you're working for the devil, that's exactly the position that you're going to be put in. So anyone who's serious about organizing and helping our people, you have to be economically independent, because if you're not, it's only a matter of time before the white man is going to make you choose between your family and your greater African family.
Excellent. And we've witnessed a major assault over the past few generations on the young black male and young black female, and we want your take on that. Now, you know, being a clinical child psychologist, what is your take? Break it down to us in plain proletariat English, as Chairman Fred used to say, on what is going on with our black boys, what is going on with our black girls, what is really happening? What is the root of the situation right now?
Well, one thing we have to understand up front is that criminals are not born. Criminals are made. Any society can create a class of criminals out of any group that it wants to do away with. So the first thing that the African community has to get out of its head is this notion that people choose to be criminals or that people are somehow genetically predisposed to kill. Criminals are made, and all crime is a function of miseducation and economic castration. If you go back in American history 75 years and you look at the biggest killers and the biggest drug dealers and the biggest racketeers, none of them were of African descent. They were Italian, they were Jewish, and they were Irish. They were selling the drugs, they was hustling the liquor, they was selling the guns, and they were killing each other in the middle of the street getting drunk. And why? Because the American social order had not yet declared them to be white people. And as a result of that, they had to do whatever they could to put food on their families' tables. But at that time, no one raised the argument that Jews were born to commit crime. No one raised the argument that the Italian or the Irishman was born to commit crime. Everyone knew that their crime was the outgrowth of not being able to have their slice of the pie within the American social order. But around the 40s and up until the 70s, the American government deliberately sought to make all of these Southern European immigrant groups white people, beginning with the changing of the definition of the census and ending with giving the Italians the police department, giving the Irish the fire department, giving the Jews the civil service jobs that they still dominate to this day. Go to any city government in the United States and you have European Jews who basically dictate the hiring practices in nearly all of America's top municipal cities. So we need to understand that when the Jew and the Irish and the Italian vacated the organized crime, black people simply picked up where the Europeans left off. We were not given the fire department. We were not given the police department. We were not given civil service jobs. And although some black men qualified for the GI Bill beginning in the 1940s, most of them were not able to cash in on the GI Bill at that time because they were denied the opportunity to go to school and get low-interest loans because white people didn't want them moving into their neighborhood. So we have to understand that the underclass that black men currently occupy was a deliberate social and political creation by the United States government. In 1970, school districts all across America began to strip these schools of the trade school building programs. Up until 1970, most of our fathers could graduate from high school and be certified by the state to cut hair, to be an electrician, to be a plumber, to be a carpenter, to be a welder, to be an auto body repair, or an auto mechanic, or a woodworker, or an HVAC specialist. You did not have to go to college in order to make a decent living up until the 1970s. But in the 1970s, the government decided that we are going to enact a mass incarceration program to rid America of black people, and we're going to start by turning black men into criminals. But the prelude to any extermination campaign is to first assassinate the image. You have to first assassinate the image of the black man before you can assassinate the black man. When you look at any extermination campaign in world history, whether you look at the Rwandan massacre, whether you look at the Jewish massacre, whether you look at the South African massacre, and we had all type of genocidal campaigns against African people, but even when you look at the genocidal campaigns that's been carried out against people who are not African, you will see that there was a propaganda public relations campaign to make the general public feel that they would be better off without these people. In other words, the general public were desensitized to any type of egregious treatment of whatever population the government decided that it wanted to do away with. And that's exactly what they started doing to black men, assassinating the character and the image. Of course, they've been doing this since slavery, but they intensified it in the 70s so that when the police started shooting black men down on the streets and when they started locking black men up by the thousands, nobody would lend a cry because the public relations campaign that showed black men, depicted black men as nothing but criminals and people who wanted to have children and lazy-ass men were shown on the television, depicted on the radio, the newspaper, the magazine, Hollywood, Broadway. Everywhere you look where the black man's image was, it was being assassinated to pave the way to ultimate extermination. When they took the trade programs out the high schools, they dropped crack off in the 1980s. So black men, with no other recourse to earn a living for their family, were forced to pick up the drugs, which, by the way, are sold by the CIA. The Central Intelligence Agency of Obama's government is the number one drug dealer on the face of the earth. You don't get drugs unless you get them from the United States government. And the only reason why they wage war on second and third world country drug dealers isn't because they're selling drugs, but it's because they are refusing to wash their drug profits by investing the drug money in Wall Street. You can sell drugs. Freeway Ricky Ross showed us that. You can sell drugs. Lucky Luciano showed us that. He did business for the United States government, but you must do it with the government's approval. The number one capitalist economy in the United States and in the world, for that matter, is drugs. So, but the problem is that they turned the black man's image into one as the leader of the drug cartel, which paved the way for him to be mass incarcerated and somehow exonerated the government itself as being the legal drug dealer. And then under the Clintonian era, you saw mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug-related offenses, which single-handedly swelled up the prison population. And right now, as I close, we're at the last stage of the war against black men. Under Obama, you're now about to see the total eradication of America's public school system, total eradication of America's charter school system. They are about to totally destroy public education to make sure commit, sure, no young black males can escape the vicious entrapment of America's psychoacademic war against black boys. Five phases: miseducation, psychiatric medication, juvenile incarceration is stage three. That leads to psychological frustration and alienation in the mind of the black man, which leads to stage five, premature extermination. One out of every four African-American males being exterminated before his 35th and in many cases even his 25th birthday. This is all by deliberate design, and most of our black leaders ain't saying nothing about it. Our elected officials ain't saying nothing about it. The church ain't saying nothing about it. Black boys are being steamrolled under the Obama administration like they have never been steamrolled before. Record numbers of expulsion, record numbers of special ed, record numbers of ADHD medication, record numbers of suspension, record numbers of boys being kicked out of school, record numbers of charter school turning away black children. And by the way, charter schools are being used to exterminate and destroy the public schools. Let me say that again. Charter schools are being used to destroy the public schools. They are opening up charter schools to depopulate the public school to justify shutting down the public school and using that public school money to build another prison. It is time for black people to wake up, to organize, and understand that even though the situation looks bleak, we can still solve it. As long as there's a God, as long as there are ancestors, and as long as there's blood in our veins and wind in our lungs, we can change the situation overnight. Marcus Garvey, His Excellency, the Right Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, said that if black people could get to know themselves today, if we could get to know ourselves today, we would have a new people tomorrow. This ain't hard to fix, but we have to make up our minds to do it. It is a lack of willpower and a lack of unity that is keeping us in this situation. White supremacy is not stronger than black power. The only difference is white supremacy is organized and active, and too much of our black power is disorganized and inactive.
Excellent, excellent. That's a perfect segue into the question on Obama. You kind of stated your position there, but give us your further take, because many of our people believed that once President Obama got into office, that was the end of the Black Power movement. That was the end of the Pan-African movement. That was the end of struggle. And what is your take on it? Why do you think that our people have fallen under that psychosis, seeing President Obama in office and believing there's no need to struggle?
Black people have a deep-seated psychological love affair with white people. And because we are so in love with our oppressor, we don't want to see him for who he is. It's like anybody who's in love. When a man is madly in love with a woman, when a woman is madly in love with a man, the love blinds them from seeing the other person's faults. When you love a woman, you don't want to see the fact that she's an alcoholic. When you love a man, you don't want to accept the fact that he's dipping out behind your back, because your love, your emotional connection, and your emotional commitment to the other party precludes your ability to be able to assess the situation as it is. And so that is exactly the predicament African people have with white people. We don't want to see them for who they are because we're too in love with them. Black people are the ones who created this fictitious conclusion that Obama's election to the White House somehow signaled a new day for black people and a turning of the guard for white America. There wasn't a single white person who put forth the notion that by putting a token half black man in the White House somehow suggested progress for African people. Anyone who knows the history of slavery knows that during the enslavement of African people, even during colonization in Africa, the European would always dress up certain black people who had influence over other black people and put them in prestigious positions so they could make their people think times were getting better when they were actually getting worse. They've done this with Jesse Jackson. They've done this with Al Sharpton. They've done this with countless numbers of black men and women, but the the fact that we allow white supremacy thinking to outthink us is what hurts us. Obama was not put in the White House because America is suddenly feeling sympathetic for black people. What did the late, great, and master psychologist Amos Wilson told us? Whenever things are about to get worse, you want to give the appearance that things are getting better. Whenever
That's
things
right.
are about to get worse, you want to give the appearance that things are getting better. Obama was only selected and appointed to be the face on white supremacy because he doesn't make any decisions. He's just the face. The presidency of the United States is not a person. It is an office. And there's many faces in that office, but there's just one face that's on the person. He is the mascot of white supremacy, nothing more. But the reason he was chosen is just before the election of Obama's first term, the United States government and its capitalist bankers had discovered that 70% of the world's untapped resource oil and gas was in the Gulf of Guinea. They have since found even more untapped oil and gas in Africa. In fact, under current estimates, it is estimated that there's more gas and oil in Africa than there is in the entire Middle East. So if America wants to get back into Africa and recolonize in the interest of resources, we can't send another white man because Africa already knows what white people have done. We're going to have to put somebody in Africa who looks like them. What better person to use than a black man with a black African father, allegedly, because that hasn't been proven, but a black man with a black African father who was born of a white mother. If we send him into Africa, the Africans will go crazy over the fact that the United States has finally chosen one of their own to be the chief executive of the country, and they would gladly, gladly welcome in the United States government to exploit the resources because of their belief in Obama. And that's exactly what's happening. President Obama has successfully recolonized the mother continent under the program of AFRICOM, which is a short word for the U.S. African Command, where they have successfully implemented United States military bases and envoys in every major place on the continent that is minerally rich. Africa has been colonized, recolonized, in our lifetime under a black president. He wasn't put in there for progress. He was put in there to give Negroes all across the world, not just in America, the illusion of inclusion. The illusion of inclusion. And under Obama, you have seen more black men go to jail. Under Obama, the black unemployment rate is one of the highest in history. Under Obama, public school is being shut down. Under Obama, black people's so-called civil rights is being rolled all the way back to the days of slavery. We are in worse shape now than we were during Reconstruction. Some would even argue we're even in worse shape now than we were during slavery, because in slavery, the black man and woman was a commodity to be owned and exploited. They don't even need you now, so this isn't an oppressive movement. This is an extermination movement. Obama was not a blessing to black people. He was a curse. But the problem is most of us won't even realize that until he's no longer in office.
Right now, brothers and sisters, we're listening to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. He's hurting feelings and crushing some of you out there. Those are some other ones you already know. We want to keep right on and go right into it. You're talking about President Barack Obama being a curse to black America. I wanted to take it into what you spoke on about the medicines and the psychotropic drugs, and you spoke on ADHD. Go further into that, because I know many of our parents out there are looking at commercials and the school system's telling them that their youth are too excitable, too active, and they need to be on some kind of drugs. What is that? You said that they get paid to do that. Can you go further into that, please?
Yes, indeed. The listening audience needs to understand that every psychological diagnosis in the American and European social order equals a dollar sign for drug investors and for people in the mental health business. In other words, whenever you diagnose a person or a child, but I'm going to focus on the children, when you diagnose a child with ADHD, or you diagnose a child with conduct disorder, or you diagnose a child with oppositional defiant disorder, or you diagnose a child with disruptive behavior disorder, by virtue of the diagnosis, the psychologist, the psychiatrist gets reimbursed by that child's medical insurance just by virtue of him having the diagnosis. In other words, in most states, in order for you to get paid for therapy, you have to diagnose a condition. If you don't diagnose the condition, you may not get paid. And if you say the child needs medication, that's a higher reimbursement. And if you say the child needs intensive case management, that's a higher reimbursement. And if you say the child needs residential treatment, that's a higher reimbursement. In other words, the worse you can make a child look, the more sick you can make him appear, the more crazy you can present him to the mental health medical exploitation system, the more money you get paid. Now let's go into the school system. In the school system, we have school psychology, which is basically the operation of special education. Now, school psychology is a little bit different than clinical psychology, but both of them are equally financially exploitative. So, for example, I'm a school psychologist, an expert school psychologist. So when I evaluate children, and in schools we're basically looking for 13 disabilities, which include the learning disability, which is primarily reading, writing, or a math disability. You have basic reading skill, reading comprehension, reading fluency. Those are the learning disabilities. But then you have 12 more. You have mental retardation, which President Obama renamed intellectual impairment or deficiency, same thing. You have emotional disturbance, speech and language impairment, blindness, deafness, traumatic brain injury, autism, multiple disabilities, other health impairment. So if you diagnose a child with one of these special ed disabilities, the school district gets money from the United States Department of Public Education for every child that's in special education. On average, a special ed child receives twice as much money as a regular education child. So let's take Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, the average public school child gets $9,000 spent on their education, $9,000. Now, of course, that's going to drop now with all the school closing and budget cuts because they need that money to build jails. But $9,000 is what it was most recently. If Dr. Umar Johnson diagnoses your son as learning disabled or retarded or autistic or emotionally disturbed, or if I put him in special ed for having a health impairment for like ADHD, he's not worth $9,000 anymore. He's now worth $18,000. The special ed children are twice as much money as the regular ed children. And the schools get that extra money each and every year that the child is in special ed. So let's say your son is a second grader. He's going to be going to the third grade this coming September. Well, guess what? He has 10 more years of school left. So if the school is going to get $9,000 extra dollars for every year your son is in special ed, he got 10 years of school left times $9,000, that's $90,000 extra on top of the regular $9,000 that the school district is going to get for your black boy or girl. So that's one kid is worth $90,000 for 10 years in special ed. If he goes to special ed in first grade, okay, he's worth $120,000 across the whole year. This is extra money. Remember, we're talking about extra money. We're not even talking about the regular money. So that's for one child. How about 100 children? How about 1,000 children? How about 1 million? How about 2 million? Right now in the United States of America, there are 2 million predominantly African, so-called African-American children in special education. There's also 2 million black people in jail. 2 million special ed kids equals 2 million prisoners, and that's a deliberate statistic. Why? Because special education becomes the highway to prison. When black kids are put in special ed, they are subject to an inferior education. That inferior education leads to dropout. It leads to most of them not receiving a high school diploma. Because after all, one of the things that the United States Department of Education is doing, and Obama is totally behind it, they want to make sure that every state has a mandatory graduation examination before Obama leaves office. So even if your son earns straight A's and B's in school, even if he was an honor roll kid his whole life, If he fails the graduation test, he doesn't get a high school diploma. This forces him into the underworld, which ultimately lands him in jail. The school-to-prison pipeline is a real thing because the state controls education and the state controls incarceration. And every state in America since 1990 has increasingly spent more money on incarceration than education. And in the next 10 years, you won't even have an education system. All you will have is a mass incarceration system. And as someone who works in jails and works in schools on a regular basis, I can tell you that some of these new prisons, state-of-the-art jails, are in better condition, than the schools where our children are being taught. If anyone disagrees, let me give you 10 quick facts. Number one, the Drug Enforcement Agency of the United States government classifies Ritalin as a Schedule B drug. That means Ritalin is classified by the DEA, not Dr. Umar, but by the DEA as a Schedule B drug. That means it's in the same category as cocaine and opium for abuse potential and addiction potential. Fact number two, the United States government started okaying the use of Ritalin, which is scientifically called methylphenidate, on black male populations in 1980, the exact same year that they brought crack cocaine in the black community, they brought Ritalin in the black community. They started drugging the adults and drugging the children at the exact same time. Fact number three, in the late 1960s, the United States government put money behind a research program to investigate the long-term side effects of psychiatric medication on the black community. In other words, the psychiatric drug war, crack and Ritalin, was planned 10 years in advance as the result of a federally funded research project that showed that if you drug black people, you could politically neutralize black people. And that's why when the Black Panther Party of yesterday began to investigate the drug dealing in the black community back in the 60s, it led them where? To the police department. We know for a fact, and this is the next fact, that the CIA has undercover operatives in every police district in every major city in America. To stop drug selling? No. To facilitate drug selling is to kill off any revolutionary leaders or organizers who try to shut down the drug movement, because if you shut down the drug movement, you shut down Wall Street, because the American economy is based on drugs. The American economy only functions because of illegal drug activity. The next fact that your parents need to know is that these drugs that they're giving our boys, this Ritalin, Adderall, Cyclerch, Dotera, Vyvanse, Concerta, Depakote, Ritalin, Zoloft, Paxil, and the list goes on, have some very devastating side effects, such as they kill brain cells on contact. They also affect your son's ability to reproduce. When your son is old enough to have children, a lot of them won't be able to have children because the drugs erode their ability to produce healthy semen. But the psychiatrist ain't telling you that. The school principal ain't telling you that. These drugs are nothing more than a eugenicidal strategy to cut the black population down by giving our boys drugs in childhood. We also need to know, and I'll let this be the next one, the last one, for this statement, and that is that the United States government in 1980 funded a project called the Federal Anti-Violence Initiative. I want your listeners to do their research on the Federal Anti-Violence Initiative. This was a federally funded project that investigated how to control black male revolutionary energy. They said that black men were born with a gene that predisposed them to be violent. They say that black men don't kill because they're miseducated. Black men don't kill because they ain't got jobs. Black men don't kill because of post-traumatic slavery disorder. Black men don't kill because of the stress of racism. Black men kill each other because they are born with a gene. Their DNA from Africa is defective, and it predisposes them to kill each other. And they actually did research, and America's top psychiatrist at the time, whose name was Peter Goodwin, and anyone can research this if they don't believe it, America's top psychiatrist at the time said that if you want to stop black violence, if you want to control black men, give them brain drugs. Give them brain drugs. He said black men are like monkeys in Africa. He said they were like monkeys who don't want to do nothing but have sex and kill each other. And if you want to control black male aggression, you got to control it the same way you would control a primate's behavior, and that's by giving them drugs. So I want your listeners to know that the reason why their sons are being given medication is so that the American social order can prevent the rise of a black messiah who could electrify the militant black nationalist movement. In the 60s, they would kill him and throw him in jail. But in 2012, 2013, they have a new strategy. They kill some and they put some in jail. But for the baby black boys, they are simply going to docilate them with psychiatric medicine. This is what they're doing. And your parents need to know that no principal, no teacher, no school nurse, no school counselor, no school social worker has the right to tell them that their children need to be tested for ADHD. No educator has the legal authority to tell you your child has ADHD because they are not trained as psychologists. They are not trained as psychiatrists. They are trained as public school teachers, and most of them can't even teach. Your ass can't even teach, and you got the nerve to want to give out expert mental health advice. How about you learn how to teach first before you start telling me about psychiatric illnesses and disabilities? Don't let nobody tell you your son needs drugs. Don't no black boy need medication to get an education. And we as the black community need to understand that we're going to have to build independent schools for our young African boys because public school is over. So every organization is going to have to take on a responsibility of building not a charter school but an independent black revolutionary academy for our young men, because if we don't, they won't have nowhere else to go. If we keep them in the American social order, they are all going to be homosexualized and lesbianized. And by the way, homosexuality ain't nothing more than birth control. Lesbianism ain't nothing more than birth control. When black men sleep with other black men, no babies are being born. When black women sleep with other black women, no babies are being born. I had a homosexual brother call me up one day. He sent me an email. He said, Dr. Umar, I love your work. I watch you on YouTube every day and every night. But I got a problem with the fact that you're telling me that as a homosexual, I can't contribute to my people's uplift. Why can't I be a homosexual and be a nationalist at the same time? I said, brother, let's look at the word nationalism. The word nationalism comes from the root, the same root as the word nature, N-A-T, which means to proliferate, to reproduce, to extend yourself into the future. If you are a homosexual, brother, which means you're sleeping with men, you're not reproducing yourself. You're not bringing your ancestors back in the world. You're not giving us another generation of revolutionary ancestors. You are killing our rebirth. You are killing our reproduction. So you cannot be a homosexual and be a nationalist, because nationalism is based on nature. The protection and proliferation of oneself and homosexuality is anti-nature. It prevents black people from being born. So you cannot be for death and for life. You cannot be homosexual and a revolutionary pan-African nationalist at the same time. The terms are mutually exclusive.
Excellent, excellent. Brothers and sisters, you're listening to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. We're going to take your calls right at the top of the hour. Number to call is 646-478-4447, 646-478-4447. Dr. Umar, tell us what you think about the state of Africa right now. We're just coming back with the new Black Panther Party from the continent. I know you've been and you travel. What do you think is happening right now on the mother continent, the reelection of President Robert Mugabe, and so much is happening? What's your take right now on Africa?
Africa, the political state and condition there, is actually a mirror of what you have here. But because black people are under the illusion of inclusion here, and they really don't have that type of illusion in Africa, because in some places our folks ain't doing too well there, they're more ripe for revolution in Africa than they are in America. I said it when I was in South Africa back in 2009 and 2005. I said, if I let I could start a revolution here in one day, because the
Absolutely.
Brothers and sisters understand their condition. The difference between the psychological condition of blacks in America and the psychological condition of blacks in Africa is that blacks in Africa understand that they are in trouble. In America, you got to convince black people that they are in trouble. You got to stop brothers and sisters on the street, and you literally got to force them to understand that they are in trouble. They got LeBron James, and they got a DVD player, and they got a car note and a nice house next door to some white people with a pool in the back. So it's hard to convince them that they're in trouble. But in Africa, they don't have all of that. So many of our brothers and sisters over there are ripe for revolution. But the problem of the African in Africa and the problem of the African in America and the African in London and the African in the Caribbean and in Canada and Australia is the same, and that is the black bourgeoisie. The black bourgeoisie, the hand-picked African heads of state, the hand-picked civil rights leaders in America, the hand-picked Negro leaders in London and in the Caribbean, they are keeping our people back. Ever since 1965, white supremacy reorganized itself and sophisticated itself, and they said instead of us going out to fight black people ourselves, instead of us arguing with black folks in town hall meetings, why don't we train a group of Negroes who will do exactly what we would do, but they would do it in black skin, which would actually make their people think that they're working on their behalf. And that's exactly what you have all across the world. The talented 10th, the Negroazi, Kumluminati, elitist blacks, handpicked our white supremacy to keep black people in order. And this black bourgeoisie basically consists of five families, just like the mafia. You got five families of the black bourgeoisie. You got the black higher education bourgeoisie. These are the PhDs and the MDs and the PsyDs and the JDs. These are the Negroes working at white colleges, and some of them even call themselves Afrocentric, but they don't do a damn thing for black people. They talk black, but they live white, and they think green. And all these Negroes do is write books and give speeches and give lectures, and whenever white folks ask them what's wrong with black people, instead of saying that white supremacy is what's wrong with black people, they blame black people for their problems. This is Bill Cosby and Don Lemon and all these handkerchief-head Negroes who don't want to hold white supremacy accountable for the condition that black people in. They just want to play blame the victim politics. I don't have a problem with Bill Cosby and Don Lemon, who's a homosexual. I don't have a problem with them telling black people that you need to begin to work to solve your own problems. That's the same thing I teach. As a Garveyite, we don't believe in waiting on white people to solve our problems. We solve them ourselves. That's the essence of self-reliance and self-determination. But although I'm going to hold black people responsible for solving their problems, I'm not going to hold them responsible for creating them. We don't control the prison system. How in the hell can we be blamed for being in jail? We don't control the educational system. How in the hell can we be blamed for our kids not being able to learn? We don't control the political system. How in the hell can we be responsible for Obama not carrying out the agenda of black people? So these type of Negroes are handpicked to explain away white supremacy, to protect their masters. So you got the higher education Negroes, and then you got the media Negroes. These are black people with radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, magazines, and they spend the whole magazine talking about Kanye West. The whole magazine, Jay-Z's new album. The whole magazine, Beyonce's baby. The whole magazine, the next tour, the next party, the next this. You never hear about no real necessary information that black people need to know about. They're not doing an expose on mass incarceration. They're not doing an expose on the public school shutdown. They're not doing an expose on the fact that black women have the highest infant mortality rate in the Western world, that black babies are being born dead from perfectly healthy mothers every day, a white supremacist conspiracy. They're not talking about that. All they want to do is entertain Negroes long enough for black folks to kill them off, then for white folks to kill them off. The next family is the economic family. These are black folks who are worth $500 million or more. This is Oprah. This is Bill. This is Jay-Z. This is Bob Johnson. These are black people with lots of money, but they don't use that money to help black people. This is LeBron and all these athletes out there who don't do nothing for black people. Every time you see them giving out money, they're giving it out to white organizations, the United Way and the Boys and Girls Club and all this stuff, but they ain't got a damn dollar for nothing that we're trying to do for our own people. And then the next family is the status Negroes. These are black people with titles. I'm the chief of police. I'm the chief of the school board. I'm the mayor. I'm the city council player. I'm the block captain. I'm the vice president of the police union. I'm the president of this. I'm the secretary of that. A whole bunch of handkerchief-head Negroes with titles who ain't doing a damn thing to help black people. Are there exceptions to the rule? Yes, there's exceptions to every rule. But let's not let the exception hide us from the truth of the rule. And who is the last bourgeoisie family. So you got the status bourgeois, you got the higher education bourgeois, you got the entertainment bourgeois, you got the money bourgeois, and the last of the five families is the religious bourgeoisie. These are the mega church ministers and the mega mosque imams. That's right. Nobody is excluded from this. I don't give a damn if you're Muslim, Christian, Jehovah Witness. They all guilty because all they doing is teaching our people how to accept mistreatment and pain and oppression as if it's some sort of God-ordained phenomenon for which they will be rewarded if they just suffer patiently. The black church is like a drug that people go to get a fix and an emotional escape from the everyday pain. My problem with the black church is not religion. My problem with the black church is y'all don't have no solutions, no institutions. Y'all don't put nobody to work, and yet and still you got a $20 million prayer house in the middle of the ghetto, and you, in order for your church to stay open, you got to rely on poor black people to put their paychecks into your offering cup so you can pay your mortgage every month, and then your money that black people give you, the so-called Jesus money, don't go to Jesus. It goes to white bankers, and those white bankers give black Jesus money to white real estate developers who come into our neighborhood, build condominiums and mansions, and price our grandmothers out of their own house that they bought 20 years ago because she can't afford to pay the property tax. These black churches are weapons of mass destruction who don't organize black people to solve their problems, but teach them to be comfortable accepting hell because the reward for accepting hell is heaven after you die. I don't belong to any religion that teaches me that I can't have heaven until after I die. I believe that I can have heaven now. I want it now. I'm going to build it now, and I'm going to take it now, and I don't need permission from Jesus, Muhammad, Allah, or Jehovah for me to exist on this planet. Any religion that's going to compromise my current predicament is a religion of white supremacy. I don't care if the imam is black or white. If you're teaching me to accept this nonsense as a God-ordained phenomenon, you are an accomplice to white supremacy. Period, point blank, end of story, with no exceptions.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Brothers and sisters, we're going right to the phone lines. I know you're anxious, and we're at the top of the hour. And I want to keep my word. We'll take the first call here. Area code 917-855. 917-815. You're on live with Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, your host, Sean Saddam Kweli. Give us your question or comment, Black Power.
Hi, how are you? Can you come back to me?
Yes, we're here. Go right ahead.
Yes, can you come back to me? Because I don't have a question just yet.
Okay, we'll come back to you. Put your hand back up. Next call here, area code 401-663. You're on live, Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam Kweli. Your question or comment, Black Power.
How you doing, guys? My name is Antonio. I live in Rhode Island, and I'm working on my MSW. So, I've been listening a lot to Dr. Umar, and I wanted to see, what I should really get into. I'm really trying to help the race out, you know what I mean? And I just kind of, I'm young and I got a lot of ideas in my head, but I kind of want to figure out which way I should head in.
Well, number one, what I would say in response to that is whatever you're going to get your degree in, turn that into a weapon of mass construction for your people. So, for example, you're going to get your master's in social work. Well, guess what? You get your license as a clinical social worker. You'll be able to do therapy with black people who are suffering under white supremacy. We have all types of psychological issues that we are not dealing with as a people. We have people addicted to heavy drugs. We got people addicted to cigarettes. We got people addicted to alcohol. These are all strategies that our people are using to try to escape the pain of white supremacy. We have sexual predators in the black community. Yes, it's not just white people going around raping our little children. It's black people who are doing it as well. I've been dealing a lot with a lot of families who got sexual predators in their family. And then we got to do treatment for the victims of that because we know that black boys who are sexually abused are at an increased risk of growing up to be homosexual. And black girls who are sexually abused are at an increased risk of growing up to be bisexual. So you getting into the social work field, my brother, we can use you in that field. We don't have enough unapologetically African mental health practitioners. Feel free to get in contact with me after the broadcast. I'll be sure to give out my contact information, and I would love to speak, you know, further with you about that, give you some advice and some pointers, and be a role model for you as you continue in your studies. I don't want to use the word mentor, because we know the word mentor actually comes from the Greco-Roman homosexual nomenclature. A mentor was the white man who would take the white boy and sodomize him into a life of homosexuality. That's where the word mentor comes from, and you flip mentor around and you get torment. They tormented their boy sexually, so we don't like to use the word mentor. But also, I want to let you know that I'm going to be up in Boston, Massachusetts, because I know that's not too far from you. I will be at the National Conference on Mass Incarceration, Dick Gregory and myself. That's October 3rd through the 5th, Boston University, mass conference on mass incarceration. So if you need the flyer for that, just email me or text me outside of the show. But keep doing what you're doing. Stay focused. Do not join the black bourgeoisie, and do not marry outside your race.
Thank you, brother. And actually, I'm on the website right now for the churchandprison.org.
Oh, give thanks.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Carl. Appreciate your call. Next call here, area code 215-982. 215-982, you're on live with Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Give us your question, your comment. Go right ahead. Black Power.
Black Power, Salam Saddam Kweli, my brother. Black Power, Black Power. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Love you, brother. I'm Brother Haru Kahuti, Brother Jerry from Philadelphia. New Black Family.
Oh, Brother
Party.
Jerry, what's up, man?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We blessed, bro. Listen, man. Keep doing what you're doing in the way that you're doing it. You might not wake up the whole race at one time, but you're doing your job. I'm really, you know, I'm inspired. I know you, and we work very well together, you know. And see, I'm so glad to have you on board with the Million Youth March, because you really need to hear your message also. You know, and it's the same message, Black Power, and it's the same message, know yourself and love yourself, you know, and love your family, you know. So I'm not going to take up a lot of time, you know. I just want you to stay encouraged to do and do what needs to be done, my brother. You're doing a great job, you know, because you inspire me in a lot of ways. I study you. You know, but thank you, Brother Kweli, for giving us Umar Abdullah Johnson today. You know,
good job, Black Power. Yes, sir. Appreciate you. Thank you so much, Brother Haru. Thank you so much, Doctor Umar. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just want to say, as Brother Jerry said, I've known him for years. I worked with him and King Samir Shabazz through the years, which is good hearing his voice. I hadn't seen him in a while because my travels have been keeping me out of Philadelphia. This was actually my first week at home in quite some time. I was sitting down on the chair yesterday with some of the elders from the UNIA down on Cecil B. Moore, and I was out there for the Cecil B. Moore Jazz Fest here in North Philadelphia. So it's always good to hear, you know, a native voice back home. You know, I travel so often now that I don't get a chance to come back through Philadelphia. Then there's a possibility that I'll probably be relocating to either Detroit or Chicago, and I'm very much looking forward to that, but I'll still make sure I keep in touch here in the city of brotherly love. But thanks for those words, Brother Jerry.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Brother Jerry, now known as Brother Haru Kahuti. Thank you for your call. Next caller, your area code is 504-432. 504-432, you're on live. Black Power Rail, this is Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam Kweli. Give us your question, your comment, talking about the destruction of black boys and girls. Black Power, go right ahead.
Black Power, which I got two quick questions. I got one for Brother Umar, and I'm going to have one for you, Brother Sean. Brother Umar, you're an inspiration. I like what you're doing. I heard of you when I was looking at this documentary, Hidden Colors. Now, my question to you, how do you feel about people people breaking away from the public school system and starting their own thing, you know, teaching the youth, the Africans
well,
in the school.
That's the only way to go. Independent revolutionary education. And I say independent revolutionary education because you have some independent African-centered schools, but they're not teaching our children about white supremacy. They're teaching them how to beat the drums and how to speak Swahili. That's not enough. You got to teach them about their enemy. They need political science, not just history. My critique of the current African-centered movement is that all we're teaching our kids is history. We don't live 5,000 years ago, and that is necessary for them to be taught that because it's part of the complete knowledge itself. But it's not the only thing that they need to be taught. So we have all these black children who are very knowledgeable about the pyramids and very knowledgeable about the kings and the queens of Nile Valley culture. But what about white supremacy? What about the Trilateral Commission? What about the creation of AIDS? What about mass incarceration? Where did this homosexual movement come from? Why are so many black children being born with infant mortality issues? They need to be told about their economic and political time of day now. Teach the past, but also teach the present. What good is an African child who's historically knowledgeable but politically retarded? It doesn't make any sense to know everything about the past and nothing about the present. Teach them both. And so that's why I'm working to build an independent revolutionary Pan-African school district. And that school district is going to be based on six sciences. I believe that if we want to take power back in the world, because as I said earlier in the show, we're not trying to share shit. Don't nobody share power. White people don't share power. Jews don't share power. Arabs don't. Everybody's fighting to control. Nobody's fighting to share. Fighting to share. So the six sciences that I believe our children need to be taught are military and political science. The art of self-defense. If a young 8-year-old got to pick up a gun and defend his mother or his brother, he should know how to do that. Okay, he should know how to clean his urine if there's no drinkable water so he can drink it. They have to be taught how to live off the land. It is absolutely essential. And then they have to be taught political science, which is the science of white supremacy and beyond. And then we have to teach them financial and economic science. Black people are financially illiterate. We don't understand economics. We know money, but money is only one aspect of economics. Economic power is greater than money because economic power prints the damn money. We have to teach them about the resources of Africa, what they're worth, what we got to do to bring their value to the surface so African people can benefit over and above Europeans who are exploiting Africa, how to build multinational corporations, how to invest in Wall Street and take the whole damn thing over, how to cripple the European economic order and raise the African economic order. We have to teach them the science of diet and nutrition, how to eat to live. We also have to teach them the science of agriculture and agronomy, how to grow your own food. I have 6 college degrees, but I don't know how to plant and grow my own food. I was never taught that, and I'm a doctor. So that education meant nothing if you can't even sustain life. So even with 6 degrees, I am a victim of miseducation. And because I know it, I have to make sure the next generation are not victims of miseducation. And then the next science we're going to teach them is the science of African spirituality and cosmology. We're not going to knock anybody's Christianity. We're not going to knock anybody's Islam. But we also want our children to know that there was a science in existence before Muhammad ibn Abdullah, and it was a science in existence way before Jesus Christ. African people are people of the stars. And we have to teach them those ancient texts. And we have to teach them how to deal with their ancestors, which is something they're not going to learn at the mosque or the church. So they don't have to give up the Islam or Christianity. All they got to do is blend it with their African spirituality, which I would argue is our secret weapon that we are not using. Generations of ancestors are behind us. Tens of thousands, millions of ancestors are standing by our side. Everybody from our blood ancestors, the Harriet Tubman, the Ida B. Wells, the Mr. Garvey, the Fred Douglas, they are with us in spirit, but cannot help us because we don't believe that they are with us. So we're going to teach them the science of the ancestors. And then the last science is the science of the black family. No institution will work if the family doesn't work, because if you don't come out of a healthy family, any institution you go into, you're going to work to destroy it. I'm going to say that again. If the family institution doesn't work, no other institution will work, because a family that is unhealthy is producing unhealthy children, and unhealthy Africans will seek and destroy any institution that they get involved with. And that's why our organizations have so much difficulty staying afloat, so much difficulty making forward progress, so much difficulty keeping peace. Because you're dealing with people who come out of unhealthy family situations that are filled with rage and anger and hurt and grief, And all they can do is let you feel what they have felt. They are not healthy enough to participate in revolution. One day I'm going to have to do a whole conference on the psychology of revolution, because most of us are not psychologically healthy enough to withstand the torment that you're going to get for white supremacy in a protracted struggle, whether it be political or militaristic. I'm just being real about that. And as far as the family goes, we're going to teach black girls the science of the black man. Our daughters are going to be taught us as a science. Our testicles, the energy that is in our testicles, our hormones, how we change across the lifespan, how to take care of a black man. And our sons are going to be taught the science of the black woman, her menstrual cycle. Why does she have one? What hormonal changes takes place? What is the relationship between her womb and the moon? Her womb and the moon. When should you be involved with your woman sexually? And when should you give her time to yourself? How to take care of her, how to deal with a woman who suffers from post-traumatic slavery disorder. These things have to be taught, because one of the black man's chief weapons now is the black woman, some of them who are being used by the American social order to put tens of thousands of black men in jail for child support and custody issues. So a black man got to be real careful how he chooses his woman, and a black woman got to be real careful how she chooses her man, because too many black women are being victims of domestic violence. And I can tell you for a fact that brothers in the so-called struggle, so-called conscious brothers, are also beating on their women. I know, because I get the phone calls in the middle of the night and I get the email messages. So the conscious community has to check ourselves, because we're dealing with revolution and we're dealing with white supremacy. But what about the changes that we need to make sure we affect within our own lives? And we've all fallen short. I'm no exception to that. But you get up and you keep on trying to improve. But when a brother is constantly putting his hands on his woman and don't nobody step in and check that, then you counter-revolutionary. How the hell are you going to say you're going to fight white supremacy, but you're not going to fight to keep this abusive brother away from one of our queens? So we got to deal with our contradictions in the struggle, because one of the biggest reasons why black people are not leaving the church or the mosque and coming to the revolutionary groups is because they see just as many contradictions in the conscious community as they see in the religious community.
It's powerful, powerful. Yeah, another question, brother?
Yeah, Brother Sean, this is what I wanted to say about starting up this Panther movement here in New Orleans, Louisiana. I want to ask you, I mean, do you think we can work in the community center?
No doubt about it. Every square inch in New Orleans you can work in, especially in our community, and wherever the spirit takes you to establish the movement, black man, in terms of amongst our people. Ain't no doubt about that, brother. Just move where your spirit tells you to move. Move where the answers tell you to move, and go where our people are and where our people need you the most. No doubt about that. Use community centers, whatever facilities that you can, black man. No doubt about that.
Okay, well, I'm just still reading and studying, you know, where I can, you know, where I can go out there and, you know, help some of our people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right,
take this fire off of this message tonight, and feed your spirit, black man. Feed your spirit.
Black power, Brother Sean.
Black power. Thank you so much for your cards, brother. Thank you so much. That's Brother Harold out of New Orleans, Louisiana. We'll take another call here, area code 215-215-317, 215-317. You're on live Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, give us your question, your comment. We're talking about the conspiracy to destroy black boys and girls. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. I'd like to say greetings to both of you. Can you hear me?
Greetings. Yeah. Yes, sir. We can hear you well.
All right. Yeah, man, Brother Umar, my comment first is to you, man. You are such a force, man. You are really on it, man. I've been listening to you now for months when I first heard you, and you're right on point. But I always, you know, I hear you mention Marcus Garvey. I hear you mention a lot of our past freedom fighters, but it always comes to my mind that, you know, Minister Farrakhan has been one of the most, you know, consistent in my lifetime. I mean, I've learned most of what I know from him. And, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people in the conscious community may have a problem with the Nation of Islam because of Islam, but I believe that organization even if you don't agree with everything, is a great foundation to take your message, because you've got an infrastructure there that has been in place for years. And I just believe that an organization that's already there could be strengthened, you know, tremendously by your just unity, you know, by you linking up with that. You know, I don't know, you know, why we don't just all get with that, man. Minister Farrakhan hasn't missed a beat. I mean, he's been talking the same thing you've been talking since I've known him, you know, and that's been over 25 or 30 years. And now you've caught that same fire, and you're going about it in your way, and it's being successful. My question is, do you believe that the Nation of Islam is probably one of the strongest, you know, foundational infrastructures that we have in this country and in the world as a black revolutionary, religious, and conscious, do-for-self type of organization? What's your stance on us just kind of putting all our eggs in that basket and just being who we are? That's my question.
Well, first, I would agree with you. I think that Minister Farrakhan's voice has been one of the most consistent. Without question, many people, and especially many people that I meet, have, in fact, come into consciousness by listening to Minister Farrakhan as a Garveyite, because there are, you know, a lot of similarities in the message. There's differences too, though. But again, we always unite around the similarities and not the differences. I remember being a college student. I used to download, you know, some of Minister Farrakhan's speeches, and I would read them. I definitely, without question, think that their place within our history and within our present as an organization that has served as a bridge to bring a lot of brothers and sisters over from unconsciousness to consciousness is unquestioned. That can't, you know, even be disputed. I still believe that the Nation of Islam is, as you said, one of those foundational entities and organizations through which a lot of work can be done. And although I don't publicize it, you know, I do do work, you know, with different mosques within the Nation of Islam around the country. A lot of good brothers and sisters up in the Boston Mosque, you know, I do work with them. Other mosques, the mosque over in London, England, when one of the organizations refused to let us do an event there because of my stance on homosexuality, the Nation of Islam in London responded quickly and said, bring Dr. Umar over here. We would be glad to have him. And that kept the event for that particular night from being postponed. So without question, different mosques have always, you know, supported me. I definitely have tremendous respect, you know, for Minister Farrakhan. And as I would say with any organization, you know, I'm looking for the workers. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the ideological differences, as Brother Sean said at the top of the show, should not be a hindrance at all if you're serious. Because let's face it, whether you're a Pan-Africanist, a socialist, a black nationalist, a religious nationalist, you have people who do work and you have people who want to talk all the time. And I would rather unite with brothers who are not Pan-Africanists if they are workers. So for me, my barometer of who I'm going to join forces with really has nothing to do with ideology. I'm looking for sincere people, and I'm looking for people who want to do the work. Now, as far as me joining the Nation of Islam, my political stances as a Pan-African nationalist and as a Garveyite, that wouldn't happen. But in terms of me working with them, okay, side by side on different initiatives and efforts, I don't see a problem at all with that. In fact, I'm probably going to be doing a workshop presenting at the upcoming Savior's Day. So working together, you know, there's no issue with me at all. Any of the brothers call me from the Nation of Islam, and they have. I'm there, you know, with them. So the fact that I'm not a member and don't plan on being one does not in any way, shape, or form, you know, hinder us from being able to work together. But your comments on them and what they have done, continue to done, and especially the role of Minister Farrakhan as it relates to the evolution of consciousness for so many black folk, I totally agree with you, is unquestioned, and that respect should always be due to him, and we should never let it be taken away.
Thank you, Ronnie.
All right, caller, appreciate you. Appreciate your call, and thank you so, so much. And I have to say that there would be no Honorable Dr. Khaled Abdul Muhammad, there would be no Dr. Malik Lushabas without Minister Louis Farrakhan, or even Sean Saddam Kweli, all of us, many of us, most of us, been influenced in some way, shape, form, or fashion by the institution, the Nation of Islam. And so we appreciate you, black man.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Next caller here, area code 917-348-9173-48. You're on live, Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson talking about the conspiracy to destroy black boys and girls. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments. Go right ahead.
Oh, yes. First of all, I'd like to say peace to everyone, especially Dr. Umar. This is the first time I'm on your show, my friend. First
peace.
Time I'm actually seeing it. I'm very recently, I'm conscious. I've been trying to tell people for the last 18 months or so, the consciousness is rising. Y'all got to go back to where we were as teenagers, 12, 15. I'm 37 now. So we had a conscious movement before. A lot of us, you know, we act like we forget that. I remember conscious was in rap music. And it was that great. It was actually really good in rap music, you know what I'm saying? And really what I wanted to ask you, Dr. Moore, one thing, Dr. Moore, I've seen you say you was going on a trip to the Dominican Republic. And I thought that was very interesting. I wanted to hear, did you go, are you going, and, you know, why did they call for you? Is consciousness rising in the Dominican Republic? What was behind that? Is that true?
Consciousness is actually rising everywhere where African people are. I mean, I literally, you know, have been getting emails and phone calls from around the planet, everywhere from Japan, Africans in China, Australia, most recently Africans in Mexico who are waving the red, black, and green, and they being, you know, assaulted and oppressed by the Mexican government. They standing up. We got pockets of Africans all over. And that's why, for me, Pan-Africanism will only be my only home, because the fight is identical everywhere. There's no need to fragment it. When people hear me talk about Pan-Africanism, I mean, brother, they are so energized to just know that brothers and sisters in America know that we exist. Just for me to just mention their name, to say that they're down there struggling and fighting, gives our people hope all over the place. But to answer your question, I was called. I received a phone call from two brothers, who do work down in the Dominican Republic, and they said they wanted to bring me there and that they also want to translate my many speeches and CD presentations into the language that is spoken in the Dominican Republic. I think that's Spanish, I think. But they want to translate the language over. So I spoke with the brother about 2 weeks ago. He's actually in New York, as a matter of fact, but he's going to be going back to the DR, and then that's when we're going to look for me to come over there. I got a couple places that I'm going to be traveling to in 2014, where I'm planning on going to China, Japan, Australia, France. I have an invitation from Denmark, invitation from Belgium, Dominican Republic. And it's interesting because in Europe, countries I didn't even know had black folks, got black folks, you know, and they want to bring me on over here to talk about this Pan-African organization thing. You're right, consciousness is rising. My thing is, I want us to understand that it's not just rising in America. I'm of the firm conviction that if all we want to do is pay attention to the American struggle, it's not going to pop, because the American struggle is part and parcel with the whole global African struggle. Our oppression is part and parcel with the oppression of other Africans. In other words, if Africa was not kept in the condition she's in, you wouldn't be in the condition that you're in. No people anywhere on earth, I don't care where you live, if you're black, the respect you get will never be greater than the respect ancestral homeland. It's the way it goes. Chinese people get the respect they get because the respect of China. Anglo-Saxons get the respect that they get because the respect of England. Whites in America get the respect they get because the respect accorded to the United States government, as it is for East India and other places, as it is for Japan. The reason we are disrespected everywhere we are is because we allow our ancestral homeland to be disrespected. No. You don't have to go back to Africa. And Marcus Garvey never led anything called a Back to Africa movement in the first place. The media invented that. Mr. Garvey said only those of us who had something that we could contribute should go back to Africa. And that's the same thing Dr. Umar Johnson is saying now. If you got something to contribute, go back. Now, the beautiful thing today is we have airplanes. They didn't have airplanes in Marcus Garvey day. So if you was going to Africa and Garvey's there, you had to spend 3 months on the boat over and 3 months coming back. Now you can fly to Africa and be back in pretty much the same day. So you don't have to relocate, but you must go back and invest.
time, energy, resources, and spirit. Invest in Africa, because as Africa goes, so do the West of us go. And one of the reasons why we're suffering the way we're suffering is we keep on fighting this disconnected struggle, as if the black struggle is somehow different than the black Mexican struggle. It's somehow different than the Jamaican struggle, the London struggle, the Nigerian struggle. They are all one. White supremacy is global. It is global. And the only thing that's going to destroy a global system is a global system. And revolutionary Pan-African nationalism is that system.
All right. One more thing I want to ask you about the Caribbean reparations. Do you think that's like a knee-jerk reaction to the Mau Mau settlement with England? Or are they? Do you feel that they done got it up? You know what I mean? Because I know we got a lot from the Caribbean. You know, did they get it? Did they have it in them? Or it's kind of like, okay, let me just jump into it because I see it work for somebody else.
I'm still investigating that situation and don't really have a firm enough grasp on everything I need to know to give you a good answer on that. So if you check back with me in about a week, I may be able to, but
yeah.
I don't want to give a premature answer because there's still some other things I need to look into regarding that situation. One thing I do know about white supremacy is that it likes to create a whole bunch of artificial struggles to give African people the illusion of progress so they can control how far you go. And we need to be careful about that. It's similar to the creation of the NAACP and the Urban League. And I'm not knocking everybody in the NAACP and Urban League, because I know a lot of strong freedom fighters in the NAACP and Urban League, they just ended up in the wrong organization. But the organizations were founded to give a degree of black progress without giving total liberation. So you got to be careful when you evaluate efforts and initiatives and organizations and movements to make sure it's not a government-sponsored project to actually derail the true freedom movement. And so we need to be really careful about that. As it relates to reparations overall, I'm a little disappointed in the direction it's taking. I mean, from what I'm seeing, there's fractions in the movement, and you cannot fight white supremacy this unified. So I also don't think you should be fighting white supremacy unorganized. So although I think the research that's going into the reparations fight is necessary, I do not think that fight should be put on the table until we are organized as a race, because any payout you get is not going to be what you're entitled to if you're not organized. Also, on the reparations table, I need to see what the demands are. I'm also interested in knowing how much the attorneys are supposed to be paid out of the settlement. Black people are just as greedy as white people because we've been trained by them. So I want to know, if we get hypothetically a $1 trillion reparations package, how much of that go to the attorney? Do they get $500 million? Like, what exactly is their payday, or are they doing this off the good of their heart and expecting nothing? Again, we just have to be careful about the capitalistic schemes of many Negroes who claim to be doing things for the right reasons. But if I were in charge, nothing on the reparations list would include money, because the white man's money isn't worth anything anyway. Everything on the reparations list should be resources, programs, services, institutions that never run out. In other words, the United States government, the governments of Italy and Belgium and France and of course, the United Kingdom, they will never stop benefiting from the slavery of our ancestors. You will never see a day where they do not benefit directly or indirectly from the enslavement of Africa. So therefore, any reparations paid must be in a form that never runs out or can expire. Money runs out, so that cannot be on the list. We want total control over certain resources. We want total acquisition to certain types of responsibility, certain types of freedoms that Africans get that nobody else get, certain waterways that we control and no one else control, certain industries. Whatever we get must be things that never run out, certain raw natural resources. That's what we want. We don't want no damn money. But the question is, are the leaders of the reparation struggle looking that far ahead, or are some of them only looking after their pocket? I can't say they are. I can't say they are not. I'm just saying we need to investigate that thing a little bit further, because I know for a fact that certain white banks connected to slavery have already started paying off civil rights organizations. The NAACP, certain chapters of the NAACP, they're getting money from white banks associated with slavery. Well, number one, who said they was the spokesperson for black folk? Number two, how much money did you get? And number three, are you using that for the benefit of black folk? So we need to be careful with this reparations thing. Because remember I spoke about that black bourgeoisie earlier? A lot of those black bourgeoisies are caught up in this reparations struggle, and a lot of them are only fighting this damn thing for a personal payday. Please, 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 black people, beware of the black bourgeoisie.
Excellent. Carl, did I answer your question?
Yeah, definitely, man, definitely. I mean, I have more questions, but I got on late. And I just got on, like, halfway through the show. I didn't hear the beginning of it, but.
No doubt. Brother Sean, let me throw up my website real quick. I'm getting some messages here on the internet, folks, saying what is the website because we want to order the book. The name of the book,
yes,
Psychoacademic Holocaust, Special Education and ADHD Wars Against Black Boys, Prince of Pan-Africanism Publishing. It can be ordered on my website, drumarjohnson.com. That's drumarjohnson.com. You can also email me through the website if you need to reach me, or you can email me directly at drumarjohnson@yahoo.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Dr. Umar Johnson. If you want to get with me on Facebook, I use a different last name, my Yoruba name, Ifa Tunde. So on Facebook, you want to look up Dr. Umar Ifa Tunde, and that's spelled I-F-A-T-U-N-D-E. That is my Yoruba name. It means an Ifa priest is being reborn. I'm going to be getting initiated into the African mysteries within the next year. And any questions regarding your children, any way I can help you, please talk to me before you get them tested by the school. Please talk to me before you get them an ADHD evaluation. Please talk to me before you put them on psychiatric medication. Please talk to me if you think your child is mentally gifted. Talk to me before you get them tested by the white psychologist, because a lot of them are not going to declare a black child mentally gifted. Any question at all, I am your educational and your mental health specialist. There's no excuse for any black child to be suffering when their parents have someone they can go to for free of charge to get some of this information. Detroit, I will be at the Truth Bookstore this coming Friday, 5 to 9, at the Northland Mall. Detroit, Michigan, Friday, Northland Mall, 5 to 9. Kansas City, Kansas, I will see you guys on Sunday. Chicago, I will see you next week at the African Festival. I will be speaking Friday the 30th at 7 o'clock at the Book Pavilion at the corner of 51st and Cottage. San Diego, September the 15th. Los Angeles, September 16th and 17th. Louisville, Kentucky, December the 7th. Norfolk, Virginia, last weekend in November. London, England is the last weekend in November. Excuse me. Norfolk, Virginia, the weekend before that. Seattle, Washington, October 25th and 26th. And it also looked like I'm going to be going to Oklahoma City and Tulsa coming up. So, brothers and sisters, any speaking information you need, where I'm going to be, what time, go to Facebook, go to Twitter. I post everything there. And if you don't have internet, you can always call a brother. Area code 215-989-9858. 215-989-9858. Brother Shaw.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And, Carla, thank you so much for your question. We got to get to some other calls here, but we appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, boss.
All right. Next call here, your area code is 862-252. 862-252. You're on live with Black Power Radio, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam. Give us your question, your comment, the conspiracy to destroy black boys, your thoughts. Go right ahead.
Brother Umar, Dr. Johnson, this is Dashan. How you been, family?
Oh, how you been, my brother? Glad to hear that voice.
Oh, you too, and Brother Sean as well. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Johnson, and brother, do you agree with Irritated Genie when he says that there was a conspiracy to, a mass conspiracy to effeminize black males? And also briefly, Brother Sean, I just wanted to remind the public, your listeners in the New York area, that tomorrow there will be a press conference dealing with stop and frisk at 12 noon. National Chairman Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz will be speaking at New York City Hall, the steps of New York City Hall, 12 noon tomorrow on stop and frisk. But yes, Dr. Johnson.
Indeed. Yes, I do agree with him. Without question, there is a plan to mass effeminize black boys. This plan has been in effect ever since 1972. when the Rockefeller World Population Council and Planned Parenthood International had a secret meeting where they felt that homosexuality could be the latest weapon in the population control war by influencing black boys and girls to only date people with the same reproductive organ, you could effectively reduce the black population rate. In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association deregulated homosexuality from a mental illness to normal behavior. I want to repeat that. Up until 1973, homosexuality was considered a mental illness in America. It wasn't until 1973 at the annual convention of the American Psychiatric Association that they removed homosexuality from the DSM-4. In April of 1974, the year I was born, my Earth Day will be August the 21st, 48 hours from now, God willing. We're also celebrating Nat Turner and George Jackson on that day. But in 1974, the first DSM-2, 6 printing, came out announcing that homosexuality would no longer be considered a mental disorder. In 1974 also, later that year, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger put out his National Security Memorandum 200 that told the government that population control, too many black people being born in the world, was a major global threat to American interests, which basically means a threat to white supremacy. He recommended the teaching of sex education in school. This is in the document. You can read it. He didn't say homosexual education. He said sexual education. That was the key word. So beginning in the 1980s, when I was in school and when some of you were in school, you remember we started getting sex education and health class. They started teaching us about condoms and birth control and how girls get pregnant, so forth and so on. That was just the pretext to homosexual curriculum, which is what you have now. In the state of California, the children are required to be taught about homosexual history. In New York City public schools, it has been added into the social studies curriculum, and in many state departments of education, without parents even knowing this, they have already started adding homosexual history into the social studies curriculum. We also know that in many states, one of the reasons why you don't have African history being taught is because the homosexuals have boycotted the inclusion of African history into the public school curriculum under the argument that if you're going to teach black people their history, you also have to teach them homosexual history. So without question, I would even call it a conspiracy. It's no longer a conspiracy. It is above ground. President Obama has given homosexuals and lesbians more rights in 4 years than black people have gotten in 400 years. If I live with my woman and we're not legally married, which means we didn't go get permission from downtown, she cannot benefit from my medical coverage, even though she is my wife, because we're not married through the government. But if a homosexual man is living with his lover, even though they're not married, guess what? He can still benefit from his rights. So when you talk about discriminating against homosexuals, how about discriminating against heterosexuals? Homosexuals have rights that heterosexuals don't have, and they also have rights that black people don't have. So he's without question, and again, the only thing I would disagree on is it's not a conspiracy. It is a movement. It is in your face. They are shoving it down our throats, and they are doing it through Obama.
Yes, sir, Brother Sean. Any other questions on it?
Oh, no, Brother Sean. I'm fine, family. As always, I'd like to be straight and to the point.
All right, all right.
Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson, for your call.
Thank you, my brother.
Okay.
All right, appreciate it. That's Brother Sean Farad, Your Black World, checking in. Just want to give you a quick second, Dr. Umar, to talk about the Million Youth March and why you supported your endorsement of it, why you're standing behind it. I mean, clearly you stated that throughout the show, but just your official statement on the upcoming Million Youth March and your expected presence and what's going on.
Any constructive effort to organize our people, and especially the youth who are without leadership in many aspects and who are craving the necessary leadership, I have to support the Million Youth March because I believe, and I'm sure that it will be, a galvanizing event to bring our young people together, male and female, to come together under leadership and under organizers who are able to then go back to their respective cities and put these young people to work, put them to study, put them into building their own businesses and entrepreneurship, and put them towards dedicating their work and contributing their their efforts through volunteerism throughout the African community, because that's what we need. We need a lot more volunteerism. We don't have a lot of volunteerism. And I can tell you, I'm probably the most requested speaker in the conscious community, and a lot of other brothers who do what I do, they don't really have a lot of volunteerism in them. Some of them do, but it's like, if you can't pay, then you don't play, you know. And we have to, you know, it's okay to get paid for doing what you do, but at the same time, you got to have a way that you give back. My give back is by working with parents and by working with children. Obviously, as a psychologist, most of what I do, you know, I do it, you know, confidentially, because I'm sworn to that by profession. You know, so most of what I do, people will never know the things I've done for people, nor do I want them to know, because I believe my reward is with the Most High and with the ancestors. But getting back on my point, you know, I really think that this Million Youth March is going to energize a lot of young people and not so young people, because it's for all ages. Even though it's called the Million Youth March, everyone's welcome, because we can't cut the head off the body, and our eldership is our head. So this is for everyone, and I really think that this is going to galvanize that spirit of volunteerism and revolutionary courage that we need for our young people to go back into their cities and not break the law, commit crimes. But there's so many positive things that we can do for ourselves and for each other without even confronting the white man. Yes, that is the stage of our revolution. Without question, we are going to have to confront the European at some point in this revolution, and there's no hiding that fact. But that's not the first stage. The first stage is organization, and the second stage is contribution and volunteerism and doing the work that is needed. We got young men without fathers. You want to be a revolutionary? Go and be a father figure for a young man without trying to go up his mother's skirt. You want to be a revolutionary young sister? Look at all these young girls out here who got terrible relationships with their mother. How about helping them sit down with their mothers and talk to their situations? I mean, we got people out here who go hungry every day. How about feeding them? We got people who need places to stay. How about opening up a boarding home? I mean, we got elders who got to go to their doctor's appointment and they ain't got no rides to get there. How about transporting them? We need the spirit of volunteerism back. And that doesn't sound as fancy as revolution, but in my opinion, it is just as fancy. How are you going to talk about destroying white supremacy when you ain't even talking about constructing something beneficial for the elders and single mothers and youth in your own community? So I think the Million Youth March is going to bring some balance to what is needed in the black community. Yes, we need an assault on white supremacy, but we'd also need an assault on the apathy and the inertia and the disconcern and the complacency and the desensitization that black people have towards their own struggle. Yeah, we need to destroy white supremacy, but we also need to destroy the Negro mindset. Post-traumatic slavery disorder is running high in our community, and I think that the Million Youth March may be the extinguisher to put us on that path towards fixing our own problems and then fixing those external problems. Because before you can have any other reparation, you got to first have an internal reparation. Internal reparations come first, and for me, that's why I'm going to the Million Youth March, to build and to organize. I begin calls from young people saying this will be the first time they get an opportunity to meet Dr. Umar in the flesh. I'm very much looking forward to it myself. Always been a fan of the late, great Dr. Abdul Muhammad as well. You know, so yes, I endorse it. I'm looking forward to it. And we just hoping that the whole African family comes on out. Positive energy, positive spirit for a positive event.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Next caller, your area code is 917-855. 917-855. You're on live Black Power Radio. Your host, Sean Saddam Kweli, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Give us your question, your comment. Black Power, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for getting me back on. I'm calling from New York. And first I wanted to comment on the Caribbean reparations. I do think Dr. Umar's instinct is correct, because even though I haven't done a whole bunch of studying on it, I'm definitely thinking about the fact that it's apparently spearheaded by CARICOM, which means the heads of the governments in the Caribbean. And it's an interesting endeavor coming from governments. Usually those types of things come from the grassroots. So there's definitely a reason to, you know, really kind of look into it before opining. And then the second thing is, my questions are all pretty technical. They're about medications and about, so-called, you know, mental health disorders. I'm wondering, I know that, Dr. Umar, you say that ADHD is constructed, and I'm wondering what your opinion is on two other disorders.
which is one is Asperger's and the other is autism. And I'm wondering what you think of the medication of autistic children.
Okay. Good question. Number one, the latest DSM-5 that just came out a few weeks ago, if memory serves me correctly, Asperger's was removed as a diagnosis, but autism stands. The controversy, first of all, autism is a real diagnosis. And I am of the opinion that the reason why so many black children are being born autistic is because of the medication that many of the mothers have taken in utero, and also the immunizations and vaccinations that we're giving our children after they are born. Black children don't need shots. They don't need them. Shots are designed for white kids to catch diseases that a lot of black folks are immune to. Our children don't need shots. These shots are very dangerous, and they're causing all sorts of biochemical reactions, and autism is one of them. In fact, a lot of autistic kids were normal up until like age 5, and then they start turning autistic between 5 and 9 because of the increase in shots around that age, but then also the fact that the shots begin to actually take the long-term effects or the long-term side effects. So autism is real. Our diagnosis, it is real. I don't support medicating autistic children because the drugs don't solve the problems. Most of the time, the autistic kids are being medicated because of the noises they make or the behavior problems that they may have. But you can deal with behavior problems without medicine. And, in fact, I got a whole chapter in my new book talking about how to deal with behavior problems, even in autistic kids, without medication. So I'm against the medicine because the kids are going to have to take it their whole life because the medicines are only dealing with symptoms. They're not dealing with the causes. And giving an autistic kid medicine so he doesn't make noises or medicine so he's not as aggressive or medicine so he doesn't get up and act around, well, if I can't communicate effectively, what am I going to do? I'm going to act out my frustration. I'm going to act out my anger. I'm going to act out my message to you. So the behavior problems that people call them, because I don't even consider them problems, that autistic kids exemplify are a natural outgrowth of them not being able to improve their communication. But if we work with them to improve their communication, then guess what? A lot of those behaviors will go away because it's just their way of talking because they can't talk effectively, or it's their way of acting out their frustration because they haven't been taught. They haven't been shown how to communicate in a more acceptable fashion. So I'm not in support of medication for autistic kids. And, in fact, the autistic kids are getting some of the most powerful medication on the market. I'm not in support of medication. The only time I would condone medication for children is in the event of homicide, suicide, or schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is real. And if you have a child who suffers from paranoid schizophrenia where they're picking up guns and knives trying to kill relatives because they think there's something else, medicate them because you're saving a life, and saving a life is more important than the side effect of the drug. You got a kid who's talking about he's going to kill himself, he's suicidal, well, give him the antidepressant medicine because we don't want him to die. So in that case, it's best that he be medicated so that he can still be alive. Or if you got a kid who's homicide, like he's deranged, and he's just saying, I'm going to kill this guy soon as I get my hands on him, then by all means, sedate him with the medication because it's about protecting and saving lives. But when you're medicating people just to sedate behaviors, I'm totally against that, especially when there's other non-medical ways to deal with it, like teaching them. See, the reason why drugs are so popular is because parents, teachers, and doctors don't care to spend time with black children teaching them how to do things the right way. That takes compassion. That takes commitment. That takes caring. That takes concern. And truth be told, a lot of black parents don't even have that much patience or care for their kids. They would rather give them a pill. The pill is the new babysitter. The pill is the new babysitter. And only people who really care about their kids are going to say no to drugs and start showing them kids a little bit more love.
Thank you.
All right. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate it. Thank you so much for your call. Next call here. The area code is 214-672, 214-672. You're on live with Black Power Radio. Your host, Sean Saddam Kweli, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Give us your question or comment, please. Welcome to the radio broadcast.
Hey, Black Power, Brother Sean Kweli. Dr. Umar Johnson, this is Brother Hakeem Abdul Muhammad. I'm the Supreme Captain, the Deputy National Field Marshal of the New Black Panther Party. I feel blessed, honored, and privileged to greet you. Brother, I've been following you. In the morning time when I get up, I study current events, and then I go to YouTube and see what's new. Every time I look up, I see your face, and I never thought it would be this close I would get a chance to meet, greet you, and say, hey, may God, Allah, Nekupo, Umbeli, God, or Ukulakulu bless you. They say you can always tell a wise man by the signs and the symbols he bear. I was always taught that real fruit always fall right by the tree. I love Marcus Messiah Garvey. I love Frederick Douglass. And I always wonder whatever happened. So now I know what's really going on. It's you. Brother, I'm in Dallas, Texas. This is the headquarters of the New Black Panther Party where we started. You're welcome to come here. We're called the Metroplex Chapter. We have Dallas. We have bookstores, black bookstores in Dallas and Fort Worth. We've grown, and we'd appreciate it. But when you leave Oklahoma, allow us to come and get you a plane. You can our person will secure you. This is not what I'm really after. What's most important to me is to say this to you. I really, really have love, and we have respect for you. And I bring you greetings from our chairman, Dr. Nkrumah Malik Zulu Shabazz. I met him when I was a protege and still up under Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad. The brother taught me to respect people, never respect you. I have seen your work being done. I hear your voice and the love that you show for our people. We need more brothers like you. And I never thought that I would ever in my lifetime would ever be anybody that support Garveyism so strong as you. And I really, really have a lot of love and respect for you, Brother Sean. This is one of the greatest shows that we've ever done. I've seen movers, shakers, and scholars come on this program and do things that I really appreciate. But you, brother, I see you. I definitely got to give you the Black Power hug. I was taught by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad that the teaching what we are getting will make you hug your own brothers in the broad of daylight. There will be nothing parkified about what the love that you share. And for you, brother, we appreciate you very much for what you're doing. And we pray that if you need anything from us, security or whatever, we're here at your disposal. And as a Supreme Captain New Black Panther Party, our personal assist you. You're going to need some help. Because I know when I hear when Minister Farrakhan stood up, the people said the same thing about him. And I come up under the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I myself have traveled and lived in Ghana, West Africa, for 10 years. I named my son after Brother Khalid because he was a role model. And we need more brothers like yourself doing what you do. Us, here we do our work. We don't get paid. But we meet brothers like you, it inspires us to keep doing what we do because we need you to help. So we extend the olive branch to you, brother. Whatever you want to do, you just take 214-672-3918. You call me. Our personal promise is to the loan doctor. Malik will tell me it's good, and I know that he will never tell me not to. So, brother, keep doing what you're doing. May Allah bless you. And, Brother Sean, keep going at him because we're black and we're proud. Black power.
Yes, thanks for those words, my brother. Thanks so much. It always feels good when I hear, you know, a brother who's a little bit older than myself give me words of praise and encouragement. You know, two groups, and, of course, I love the support I get from all members of family, so please don't misunderstand me, but two groups that really touch my heart whenever I hear positive words from them about my work, it's children and it's elders, you know, especially, you know, our great-grandfather elders, you know, our brothers and sisters in their 80s, when they come up and they stop me and they say, you know, brother, you touched me tonight by what you said, you know, you never forget that. The other day, I had a child leave me a voicemail. He was about 8 years old. He said, Dr. Umar, I think his name was Chris. He said, this is Christopher, and I'm one of your biggest fans, and you taught me so much about black history, and I just want a chance to talk to you. I mean, it almost made me want to cry when it comes from an elder or a child, you know. And but coming from any brother or sister, especially expressed as eloquently as my brother just did a second ago, you know, it really touches me, brother, and I just want you to know that those words that you just shared, you know, with me about your love and support for me, I won't forget that. And when we meet, I will remember them because when you do this kind of work, it's not always an easy job, you know, and it can get quite taxing because most folks, they see me at the lectures, but they don't know that between the lectures, there's a lot going on that I'm trying to do for people and for my own family, you know, and it can get taxing sometimes. And, of course, we all got our naysayers out there who do what they can to try to tear us down, from bourgeoisie Negroes to Negroes who think they're conscious but jealous because, you know, you happen to be, you know, a little bit more popular than they are. You know, I'm not in this for no popularity contest. If I wanted to be in a popularity contest, I'd join Hollywood and become a rapper. I did this to help my people. You know, I didn't know 3 years ago that I would be in this position. It just all happened so quickly. One day I did an interview in Chicago with my brother Dawai Yisrael. I took that interview to a New York City lecture I did at the National Black Theater, and overnight people start posting it all over the Internet, and overnight Dr. Umar who had already been doing his work for a decade, finally became known to the whole world. Literally overnight, I started getting calls from Africa, China, Australia, literally the next day. I didn't know that that would happen. You know, I went up there to share information in Chicago about the war on black boys, and it turned me into an international personality. And I don't take this lightly. I think to whom much is given, you know, much is expected. You know, and that's why every day I wake up, I'm trying to do the most I can before I go to sleep, because none of us know how long we're going to be on this earth. So I just want to say to my brother that I thank you for those words. And when I hear those type of words, it just recharges me and reminds me of the obligation I have to our people.
Ashe, and thank you so much, Doc. I just want to make you aware of what's going on. We're now live streaming. I know you're familiar with these Blog Talk Radios. We're live streaming. We're off the regular internet. We're live streaming. We have a few more calls. I want to be respectful of your time.
Sure,
you have time
no
to
problem.
Answer these few calls?
No, we good. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, next call here, your area code is 917-855. 917-855. You're on live Black Power Radio. Your host, Sean Saddam Kweli, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Give us your question or comment, please, Black Power.
Oh, you just took my question. I don't know how you had
okay.
me twice. Sorry.
Okay, you were back in call. All right, we got you. Appreciate that. We'll go to the next call, area code 516-590-516-590. You're on live Black Power Radio. Your host, Sean Saddam Kweli, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Go ahead with your question or comment, please, and Black Power.
Greetings, brothers. My name is Copeland Richards.
I just want to say
it's an honor to actually be talking to you, Dr. Umar and Brother Sean. I'm actually starting an organization out here in New York, and one of your videos, Dr. Umar, The Seven Sciences of Nation Building, is actually the underlying curriculum for my organization and my mentoring program. I heard you guys earlier talking about the Nation of Islam, and I understand that one of their great strengths in my eyes is also one of their weaknesses, and it's the fact that their strength is the spirituality that they have and their religion. And because of the way that Christianity has been forced on a lot of us here in America, we don't want to deal with anybody or anything that's religious, no matter how positive they could be for the organization. So I understand that one of the things that we have to do is unite our people regardless of that. Because like you say a lot of times, Dr. Umar, we have to be African before we're anything else, and we have to work towards that goal. So my question is, how does a person like myself work with all of these organizations and pull them together towards a vision, being that I'm just Copeland Richards and I'm not Dr. Umar yet? Because people will follow you, and the workers will follow you a lot because of your name. How do I get them to follow the vision?
Well, number one, in this struggle that we have to do, it is very important that you don't try to work with everybody that you meet, because some people are not going along for the ride. And that's probably one of the saddest aspects of the struggle. It's like with any war you get into. You know, when you get into a war, that there's no such thing as a perfect war. Some of your colleagues are going to fall in that struggle. And in this war, to reclaim the minds of our people, it's important that you know some of them ain't going to come. Some of our people's minds have been so devastated by white supremacy, so imprisoned by post-traumatic slavery disease, that they will never see straight, nor do they want to. So one of the best things that you're going to have to learn how to do, and we all have to practice at this, because sometimes we can get overzealous with our recruitment efforts and our waking up people efforts, pick and choose very strategically who you work with and who you choose to waste your time trying to wake up. For example, you might spend 5 years trying to wake up a certain brother. And 5 years later, he go right back to his white queen and white supremacy and so forth. And you're like, my God, I put 5 years into that brother. I thought he was almost to the finish line, and he relapsed on me, okay? But if you would have took that 5 years and put it in the youth, you probably could have woke up about 500 youth that you did that for the same amount of time that you spent into that one brother. My message to you is get the youth. Get the youth. I think one of our weaknesses as a community, conscious community as well as the integrationist community, and that is that we focus too much on organizing adults. When you look at any revolutionary struggle, it is the youth that carries the struggle over. Always it is the youth. You need the elders for the wisdom and for the guidance, but it is the youth who do the galvanizing. So I believe in the 60-40 formula. Spend 60% of your efforts on people between the age of 18 and 38, and only 40% of your efforts on people over the age of 38. 18 to 38, as well as the children younger than 18, is where we should be focusing. I think we spend too much time trying to rehabilitate psychologically disordered black people who are in love with white supremacy. Focus on the youth. They are still idealistic. They are courageous, and they believe they can make a difference. Most of them have not yet been sold white supremacy. They have not yet been drafted by the black bourgeoisie. Focus on the youth. Whenever I see an 18 to 38-year-old, I start salivating politically because I'm like, I need that brother for the movement. I need that sister for the movement. That brother over there got a lot of talent. I got to get to him before Harvard or Yale or Princeton gets to him. Not that he can't go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, but I want to make sure he got his head screwed on straight so that when he comes back out, he's still thinking like an African and not like a Negropean, because too many of our 18 to 38-year-old youth are being turned into Negropeans by white supremacy because we are not bringing them in our fold and holding them. See, we like to stay in our comfort zone, and for a lot of us, our comfort zone is with people 38 and over. We got to get out that comfort zone. We got to get those corner boys. We got to get those ex-cons. We got to get those runaway children. They are the future because they are bold. They are fearless. They're just misdirected. If you can wake up them youth, you will have a whole army on your side. That's where our efforts need to go, on the youth. Garvey in his 30s, Malcolm in his 30s, King in his 30s, Lumumba in his 30s, Mega in his 30s. It is the youth that carry the movements, and so I think you should focus your time and energy on the youth. Start a study group for the young brothers or for the youth in general. You could bring the sisters in there, have a study group, get them involved in discussing and reading conscious things. Show them Hidden Colors. Show them other documentaries, and just get the intellectual juices flowing. Take them on different trips, the Great Blacks and Wax Museum, the Civil Rights Museum, maybe a trip to Africa. Get them now, because if you plant the seed, then the weeds of white supremacy will never be able to reclaim those children if you get to them first. We have to spend more time on 18 to 38.
Excellent advice. Carl, did I answer your question?
Yeah, perfectly. Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Bless.
All right.
I'm gonna send you an email on your website also, Dr. Umar, because I have a niece who I believe beyond a shadow of a doubt is gifted, and I want to take advantage of that. She's 3 years old, but I want to take advantage of that like ASAP.
Sure, no problem. We'll talk on that.
Bless. Good night, fellas.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate your contribution. Next caller, your area code is 678-682. 678-682. You're on live. This is Black Power Radio with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam Kweli. Go right ahead with your question, your comment, please. Welcome to the discussion. Caller 678-682.
Hang on one second.
Go right ahead.
Hang on one second. Hold on.
All right.
Hold on. Yes.
All right, go right ahead with your question.
You?
Doing all right.
Yeah, what's up?
All right, you got a question? We'll move forward. You may not have a question. Next caller here, area code is 304-304-365. You're on live with Black Power, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Go right ahead with your question, your comment, please, in Black Power.
Peace and hotep to you, good brother. John Kim.
Peace, hotep.
I do have a question, and that question is, where did the origin of post-traumatic slavery syndrome and the origin of black psychology? That's for Brother Umar Johnson.
Well, as far as the origin of black psychology, I mean, that would go all the way back to Nile Valley culture itself. Even European psychology came out of Nile Valley culture. A spiritual system, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, who are probably considered the two greatest European psychologists, both of them went to Africa and studied the Nile Valley culture. And actually, the word psychology is really another word for spirituality. The word psyche means soul. So psychology is really supposed to be spirituality as our psychology was spirituality, but because the Europeans don't believe in anything that they cannot control, if they can't see it, touch it, taste it, feel it, measure it, or more importantly, sell it, then they don't acknowledge the existence of it. So after Carl Jung and after Sigmund Freud, there was a revolution in white psychology to do away with anything known as the soul, to do away with anything known as the spirit. So if you talk to any psychologist today, talking psychologically speaking, most of them would not acknowledge in scientific terms the existence of a soul or spirit. But the origin is Kemet, and of course Nubia, Kush, Ethiopia, and all those that preceded Kemet. And it's important. I often refer to them as, you know, some of our master teachers have also said, you know, it's Nile Valley culture, because it really wasn't just one. It wasn't just Kemet. It was all of those. But that is the origin of psychology, which grows out of spirituality. As far as post-traumatic slavery disorder go, I would say that post-traumatic slavery disorder began to develop in African people the very first day we encountered Europeans. So you're going back 1,000 years, if not more, in time. But specifically, as far as I'm concerned, because there's a lot of people, different psychologists with different conceptualizations of post-traumatic slavery disorder. Of course, probably the most popular after mine is Dr. Joy DeGruy, who's a social worker. She's the one who wrote the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. I refer to it as a disorder or as a disease because I believe it is contagious. Okay, a Negro pen can infect a normal African with their way of thinking and behaving and feeling. So I believe it is a disease and that it is contagious, not medically contagious, but psychologically and socially contagious. But post-traumatic slavery disorder basically refers to the abnormal thinking, the abnormal feeling, and the abnormal behaviors of black people that we have been engaging in ever since we've come in contact with white supremacy. For example, just to give you some symptoms of post-traumatic slavery disorder, look at all the educated black men who marry white women without marrying their own. Black men marry outside their race more than the men of every other race in America put together. Put together. You can put all the other interracial marriages together. You still don't get, as a percentage, what black men marry outside of their race as. That's post-traumatic slavery. Look at all the money black women spend trying to look like white women. Look at all the money on gold wigs, gold extensions, blonde hair. A lot of our sisters have gotten away from the blue and green contacts, but you remember 10 years ago, that was a manifestation of post-traumatic slavery disorder. I mean, even when we look at the hip-hop industry, which a lot of people like to defend, you know, I don't have a problem defending a conscious rap, but I'm not going to defend the whole damn thing because, you know, calling women, you know, bees and misogynizing women and glorifying drug dealing, I'm not going to defend that. I can defend the art form, but I'm damn sure not going to defend the substance. And you look at some of the things that come out of the mouth of Lil Wayne and Kanye West and, you know, these types of people. Post-traumatic slavery disorder, we are sick. We are mentally sick people. After slavery and after colonialism, there hasn't been a period of healing. We have never healed from slavery. We have never healed from oppression. And as a result of that, we're trying to move forward without some sort of a healing process, and we need that. And I think that's another reason why our traditional African spiritual systems are so important, because they can heal you. You can be healed through Ifa. You can be healed through Voodoo. You can be healed through the Dogon system. You can be healed through the Akan. That is our therapy. African spirituality is our therapy, and that's why I'm studying it. That's why I encourage other people to study it, because ever since I started tapping into my ancestors, my life has been improved for the better, and I've been encouraging other people to do that. And the good thing is you don't have to leave your, you know, Islam or Christianity to deal with your religions, because African spirituality is not a religion. It is your culture. It is your culture. Dealing with the spirits, dealing with the Most High, dealing with the ancestors, that's part of our culture. It is not our religion. And that's why when you go to Africa, for example, my brothers in Senegal, they're Muslim. They're Muslim brothers. But guess what? They deal with spirit. Okay, I know Christians in Africa. They're Christian, but they deal with spirit. So nobody has thrown away the spirituality except the so-called African-American. We've been taught that to deal with the ancestors and to recognize the existence of spirits that God created that exist all around you all day is somehow demonic. That's foolishness. But the beauty of it is when I go to Africa, I can see Muslims who still practice their spirituality, and I can see Christians who still practice their spirituality. But over here, that's been outlawed by the leaders of these religions. But I don't ascribe to that. But just to answer your question, we are still sick. And until we heal the mind, until we heal the African spirit, we won't be able to heal anything else. If you don't reconstruct the African mind, you won't be able to reconstruct nothing else. You will not be able to build schools. You will not be able to build economic institutions. You will not be able to build healthy organizations. You will not be able to build healthy black families until you repair the Negro psyche. Until the white man is taken out of the black man's soul, he will never be an African. The Negro has to die and for the in order for the African to be born. And every last one of us got to kill his own Negro. Every black man has to kill his own Negro living inside of him. Every black woman has to kill her own Negro living inside of her. We all got a little white boy, and all of our sisters got a little white girl living inside of them. And until you commit suicide of the devil in you, you will never be able to beat the devil without. What good is winning a war against white supremacy in the physical world when you're still losing to white supremacy in the spiritual world?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for your comments, brother. One other thing that I would want to mention is that some time ago I read a book, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, and in that book he talked about that violence was a cleansing force because Algeria was going through colonialism at that time by the French, I believe. And he told the native population that by killing the French who had wreaked so much abuse upon them, it was a way of freeing themselves and purging themselves from that abuse. I'd like for you to comment on that quickly, if you could, sir.
Well, one thing about revolution, and I want everybody to hear this because I think sometimes we romanticize it too much. Not you, but just in general. You hear the young brothers in the conscious community, we need a revolution. Yes, we do, but this revolution is a process. It's not an event, and it's phases to it. And one thing that I've learned from all of our African revolutionaries, you know, Patrice Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, Kwame Nkrumah, you know, the Mau Mau, Dedan Kamathi, and the others, is if they could have, they would have avoided it. They only engaged in protracted military warfare because it was necessary. They did it because it was necessary. Nobody wants to lose their mother. Nobody wants to come home and find their kids cut up into pieces. Nobody wants to get their arm shot off or their eye shot off their head. Nobody wants to live in swamps with snakes and malaria. You know, there's nothing glorious about that. And I think because we've never really participated in a protracted military struggle with the European, sometimes you're inclined to romanticize it. And I just want all of our young brothers and sisters to stop romanticizing revolution. The revolution is necessary. It's not desired. It's necessary. We do it because we have to. It is what's necessary for us to achieve freedom and liberation. We don't do it because we want it. There's not a single leader of a successful revolutionary struggle in Africa who did not speak out against wishing they never had to go through that type of a hell. So we got to understand that revolutions are bloody. They are not good things to go through. You're going to lose people you love. You're going to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. It's not something you want. It is something that is a requisite of the modern world that people often end up in situations where they have to be willing to give their lives in order to overcome their enemies. It's just the way the world is run. When you study world history, you will find war has always happened because one nation always wanted to impose its will on another. And that's exactly what white people are doing to African people all over the world. So, yes, we're going to fight a revolution. But I want people to understand we're not going into this thing because we think it's some sort of great, glorious thing. We're doing it because it's necessary. And our people really need to stop romanticizing this concept because I think if a lot of them really knew what revolution truly was, a lot of them would stop speaking the words because a lot of us really are not ready. We're not psychologically prepared to go through that type of a struggle. Read the autobiographies of the brothers and sisters who participated in the Mau Mau. Read the autobiography of Amilcar Cabral. Read Patrice Lumumba's books. If you really think this is something that you want to do just for the sake of doing to get your name out there, you better think again. We do it because we know it's necessary, and it's the only way to overcome white supremacy. But I do agree with what Frantz Fanon said. I do think that at points in history, violence is necessary in order to purge a certain type of an energy and to restore another. That's necessary. But again,
going back to the preparation for revolution, I think that a lot of our people are so filled with hatred at their condition and at themselves and at the white man, that even after we achieve victory, they won't stop fighting. They will then turn their guns on each other, which is exactly what happened in certain African nations. After they achieved freedom, they had to fight each other because some of them weren't just filled with hatred for the white man. They was also filled with hatred for themselves because they had been conditioned by the white man to hate self. So we got to be clear and we got to be careful with who we organize with, because some of these people who participate in the struggle, when it's over, they ain't going to want to stop fighting. They're going to be looking for new targets. After they get rid of the white targets, they're going to be looking for black targets. So we got to make sure that our people are psychologically prepared to deal with a protracted revolution. Thank you once again, brother.
All right, Carl, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Next caller, your area code is 410-805, 410-805. You're on live with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Black Power Radio, Sean Saddam Kweli. Go ahead with your question or comment, please. Welcome to the radio show.
Hi. Well, first of all, thank you for touching on volunteerism, because how can we call each other brother, sister, and run around with a whole pep, but yet you see your sister and her kids walking in the rain, and you won't even give her a ride, or you see your brother might need a little help, and you won't even, help him out. So I think that's very important, because we have to value each other, or else the work that we do is really in vain. But what I wanted to touch on was this. I work in counseling, and I've worked in the mall for about 20 years. And so now, within it's been going on before now, but you just see more and more of it. The mental health companies that are catering to kids because they can go Medicaid for their services, and they're passing themselves off as mentoring companies. They go into the schools, and they get relations with the schools and daycare, and they don't really tell the parents that, oh, by the way, we're giving your child a diagnosis that may follow them, and the child is okay. And so I just kind of wanted to see, how do we counteract that? Like, what is the solution to report them? Or, because I'm tired of it. Like, I've went through several companies, and I talked to you last year about my company having you come down and doing training with us while I left that company, because I was just saying they have like 500 kids, and maybe out of that 500 kids, only maybe 75 really, really have a diagnosis. The rest of them, they have issues, but not where it's warranted a diagnosis that's going to follow them. And then some of them, they're like, oh, well, you got to see the doctor. So then they get them doped up on medication when it's not necessary. And then all the while, the parents don't even know that their child has been given a diagnosis kind of under the table or under the rug.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's happening all over the country. You know, it's manipulation of mental illness for monetary purposes. The psychologists and psychiatrists of America are some of the biggest pimps out. And unfortunately, there's a lot of black people who participate in this, too. I know of a school psychologist right here in Philadelphia. I'm not going to call his name, but he and I don't even speak. And we don't speak because he will diagnose a black child in a heartbeat as long as he's getting paid for his evaluation. So you got Negroes who are all up in this. People often ask me, why are you the only psychologist out here really blowing the whistle on the exploitation of black people and black children with this whole special ed, mental health, ADHD thing? I said, because most of them are getting paid through it. Most of them are getting paid through this, including some conscious people. They're getting paid through this thing. That's why they're not out there blowing the whistle, because they are pimping our damn children, talking black, living white, and thinking green. But for you, number one, make sure you don't lose your job because you need it in the meantime. So any work that you do, and your primary way of helping is by educating the parents. They don't know. They don't know mental health law. They don't know it. So what you can do is very clandestine. You got to be clandestine. You might not even use your real name. You might have to, use a African name, come up, give yourself an African name and use that when you're in the community, and start holding little workshops for parents to teach them mental health process and procedure in your particular town and state, how it operates, what you should do, what you shouldn't do.
The good thing about it, the good thing about mental health and education is the parents can advocate for their own kids. They don't need a lawyer. They can actually go in there and stand toe-to-toe with the principal and the psychiatrist on their own. If they don't agree with an evaluation, they can get a second opinion. And I need all the listeners to hear that. If you don't agree with the evaluation done on your child in school or out of school, you have a right to a second opinion, and they have to pay for it. You don't pay a penny. And I know this because I do corrective evaluations all the time. So the job is to educate those parents. If I can be of any source of support for you, sister, in doing that, then, you know, feel free to shoot me a text or send me an email. You know, that's what I do. You know, I travel all over the place, you know, training parents, teachers, and everybody else on how to get around the system that's looking to devour our young people. And it's such a shame because America is putting black people in jail for smoking crack, but they're creating a whole new generation of baby crack addicts out of black boys. These kids who are going to be used to taking these strong drugs from age 5 to age 18, you think you're going to be able to walk away from crack after you've been given Ritalin for 10 years? They're not going to be able to walk away from Zoloft after being given it for 10 years. They're going to be used to getting high, and they're going to need something else that can allow them to get high once their parents' medical insurance run out, and they're going to go straight to the drug dealers on the corner. We are letting the United States mental health system create a whole generation of baby crack addicts, and nobody is doing nothing about it because so many people is getting paid by this. The drug companies are also giving out grants. That's right. Ritalin and all these companies, they're giving out community development grants in the black community, so some of this drug money that they're making on the backs of our kids are being given to so-called progressive black organizations so they could put on programs in the black community. I'm firmly behind Marcus Garvey when the ancestors said that anything that is to be done for black people must be done by black people, and you cannot use the white man's money to fight white supremacy. You can't do it. And that's why the charter schools are suffering right now, because the charter schools thought they was going to use public money to educate black kids, and look at what they're doing now. Not only are they shutting down the public schools and using the charter schools to do it, now they're taking charters from black-run charter schools all over the country. Black-run charter schools are under threat. They are in a dying breed. I'm getting emails and phone calls like, Dr. Umar, I run a charter school. We've been up 10 years. We got a letter in the mail saying that they're taking our charter back. How the hell are you going to take their charter back? This is what they're doing. They are, you can't use white money against white people. And black people have enough disposable income. We have a $1 trillion economy. Okay, why in the hell are we begging for them to do anything for us when we have the economics to do it ourselves? But we have to organize it. And that's what we need now. We need organizers. To hell with the leaders. We've had enough leaders. We don't need nobody talking. We need organizers, people who are going to bring black people together for the exclusive purpose of building their own reality by building their institutions. White supremacy is destroying black people by way of the institutions. Why are so many black people dying from preventable diseases? It's because we are in their medical system. Why are our kids being miseducated? We are in their educational system. Why can't black men find jobs? We're trying to survive in their economic system. We need our own. Look at the Chinese. They live in America, but they got their own banks. They got their own hospitals. They got their own factories. They employ their own people. Look at the Arabs. Look at the East Indians. Look at these people. Yeah, they in America too, but they have a separate existence. So we cannot allow anybody to trivialize our right to an independent existence. Yeah, you can't be totally independent within the geographical boundaries of a sovereign nation, but you can be as independent as the Chinaman and the East Indian are. The difference is they know that America don't owe them nothing, but we think that we're going to get America to help us get ourselves out of our condition. Why in the hell would your enemy give a hand to your program? We have to do it. We can do it. We must do it. It is the 11th hour, but we still got 1 hour to go. We're in the third quarter. It's one quarter left, but damn it, we can come down and shoot a couple three-pointers. We should never give up. The same way the basketball players and the football players do it, they might be down 20 points in the fourth quarter. But damn it, they're going to go out fighting. And if they fight hard enough, they're going to end up winning that game. So it's time for us to start nailing a couple three-pointers, black people. Don't give up. The fight is still winnable. If you lose your hope,
If you lose your faith, if you lose your confidence, then we're going to lose the whole damn thing. Because truth be told, it's not about how much money you got. It's not about your resources. And it's not about your weapons. It's about your heart. It's about your heart. What did Napoleon Bonaparte say about military? Napoleon Bonaparte, so-called greatest European general who ever lived, and of course we know he wasn't the greatest because he lost to Toussaint Louverture in the Haitian Revolution, but he said something that's worth noting. Napoleon said that if he had to choose between the best equipped army and the army with the strongest will, he said, give me the army with the strongest willpower, because he said the physical to the mental was as a ratio of about 2 to 5. He said, if you got people who have made up their minds they're going to win, it don't matter if they ain't got the rifles or the muskets, they are going to win because they got the spiritual and the mental power behind them. So he said, if I got to choose between the mental power versus the physical, give me the mental. And I'm of the same opinion. Give me all the black men and women who believe we can win. Don't give me the people talking about it's impossible. Because another big contradiction we got in the conscious community is you got brothers and sisters running around screaming RBG and all this other stuff, but who will turn around and tell you we can't overcome our situation. The white man is too invincible. We'll never overcome. Then what the hell are you in the conscious community for? Why are you walking around with a red, black, and green flag? If you got a red, black, and green towel, a red, black, and green flag, a red, black, and green wristband, a red, black, and green headband, it's because you believe in nationalism. That flag represents our belief that we can be free, a sovereign, self-governing people. So don't say that we can't overcome our situation and then have on a red, black, and green wristband. That is a damn contradiction. If you don't believe victory for the African is possible, take off the red, black, and green. That is only for people who believe that freedom is possible and possible in our lifetime.
Excellent, excellent. Caller, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate trying to get the last few callers in here, but thank you so much for your call. I appreciate your participation in the conversation. Last three callers here, Doc. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. Last three callers here, Doc, out of respect for your time. Eric code here, 302-762-764. You're on live Black Power Radio with Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam Kweli. Go ahead with your question, your comment.
Assalamu alaikum, Sean Saddam. This is Sister Lorraine. Assalamu alaikum, Hotep, and Islam. How are you?
Doing
I am
great.
So excited. I'm fired up. This is
Absolutely.
Lorraine Muhammad. I'm in Wilmington, Delaware, and I just want to say thank you, Brother Sean. Thank you, Brother Umar Johnson. I'm just overwhelmed. I didn't know if I was going to get through, but it's an honor and a pleasure to speak. And also, when you came to Wilmington, I have your books, Psycho Academic Holocaust, the Special Education, and ADH, Wars Against Black Boys. Brother, you are on it. I thank Allah for you. I'm just a little excited, but Brother Umar, I just want to ask you one question. It says in your book on page 23, the emotional and behavior disturbance, the EBD classification, is the most stigmatized label against African-American boys in America in the public and charter schools. Why do you say in the public and charter schools when charter schools, well, you really answered my question just a few minutes ago in truth about white people's money, but in charter schools when we felt that it was safe to take them out of public schools and put them in charter schools? Can you?
Sure. Good question. And just to let you know, good sister, I will be back in Wilmington on Saturday, September the 7th. The president of city council has asked me to come down there and speak on the school system and the situation and what we can do to improve education for our children in Wilmington. So I'll be speaking at the request of the president of city council of Wilmington, and the event will be held at the Delaware Technical and Community College.
Yes, sir, I have that information. I will be there.
All right. Now, to answer your question, charter schools are public schools.
Okay.
A charter school, by definition, is an alternative public school, and they are required to have special education programming.
And so the same stuff that they diagnose the kids with in public school, they diagnose the kids with in charter school. And in fact, sometimes it can be worse. It can be worse. As I say in the book, the charter schools don't have extra money like the public schools have. So if I'm a charter school principal, the only extra money I'm going to get is the special ed money. So that means your child is more likely to be diagnosed with a special ed condition in a charter school than in a public school because they need that extra money that comes with the diagnosis.
Oh, my God. Wow. Wow. Brother Umar, I would always keep you in prayer. And Brother Sean, you keep up the good work. You all are phenomenal. You're great. We also give an event, and we did give out the DVDs and hand them out for Hidden Colors, but we're also giving an event in Wilmington October the 12th. I'll send you the information on Hidden Colors. We're going to be giving that coming up. Brother Sean, you keep up the good work, and may Allah bless each and every one of you. Black power, black power.
Black power. Allow blessings be with you too, sister.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Next caller here, your area code is 267-267-319. 267-319. You're on live Black Power Radio. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Sean Saddam Kwali. Your question, your comment. Welcome to the radio broadcast. Go right ahead.
Peace. I have a question for Dr. Umar. I was wondering if he would speak on the Russell Simmons Harriet Tubman sex tape fiasco. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
I thought what Russell Simmons did was worthy of this communication from our race. That was despicable. We've never had a Queen Mother Shiro like Harriet Tubman be so disrespectful that this Negro, who was formerly married to an Asian and now he's dating and is preparing to marry this white woman, would allow one of those Def Jam comedians to put on a skit where you have Harriet Tubman enticing her slave master through sex so that she can bargain her way into freedom with another black slave looking on, hiding in the closet as she entices her slave master with sex. That was ridiculous. It was disrespectful. It was insulting. And the black bourgeoisie didn't even criticize Russell Simmons because of the money that he has. And he should not have gotten away with that. He should have been totally bombarded by black leadership with what he did, and he almost heard from no one. And the poor excuse that he gave for why he did it was just not acceptable. He would have never done that with a Jew. Put on a skit about the Jewish Holocaust. You would have never done no nonsense like that. But you're going to let some filth, a little mini-movie, on our Queen Mother Harriet Tubman, and I take that personally because she's my number one hero, period. Even before Douglas and Garvey, she comes in my life. You know, this woman did what she did, freeing over 300 slaves, mostly by herself, building an old folks home for black folks, serving as a nurse and a spy and a scout in the Civil War, being led by God on her missions, freeing her family and still not giving up, going back to free more in the United States Army, not even giving her a military pension when she applied for it. I mean, this woman is everything that you can be to a people, the greatest woman who probably ever lived, okay? And you're going to disrespect her legacy and disrespect her memory and disrespect all of us by having some nonsense, goofy, comedic mini-movie of her enticing her slave master with sex so she could get her freedom and thinking it's funny? Some type of goofy comedy that they did? He should have been bombarded by black folks, and he should have been totally excommunicated from our people, but he wasn't. So not only does that show how trifling Russell Simmons is, but it also shows how trifling black leadership is to let him get away with that nonsense. And I don't know if he's planning on being at the Million Youth March, but if he is, he needs to be made to get on that stage and apologize, and he also needs to be made to donate money to put our young black teenagers to work, because black teenagers have the worst opportunity of finding employment in America. They would rather hire a Mexican or an Arab child than they hire one of our children. But not only does he have to apologize, that man has to pay reparations to us for disrespecting our Queen Mother. I was just at Harriet Tubman's grave up on July the 4th or July the 5th
when I was honored by going to Rochester, New York, to read my great ancestor's 4th of July speech. So we can't just accept no apology, brothers and sisters. That man is a multimillionaire. He has to pay reparations, and I demand that he pay reparations by putting up at least $5 million to be used to build independent schools for African children and to be used to put our teenagers to work. Don't let him get on the microphone at the Million Youth March and say he's sorry. That ain't enough, nigga. You got to pay money. We want reparations for you disrespecting the legacy of the great mother, Queen Harriet Tubman.
Excellent. I don't even know if he will be there. There's no confirmation. But if that does happen, we're going to follow suit with that. That's got to happen. Carla, thank you so much for your call. We'll take a last call here. Area code 803-743-803-743 on live Black Power Radio. Sean Saddam Kweli, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Go right ahead with your question or comment, please. Welcome and thank you.
Hi, Dr. Johnson. My name is Orna. I've been diagnosed with ADHD while I live with my grandma. And I moved with my aunt in North Carolina, and I got to start school next week. And my aunt don't want me to take it because she think I don't need it, but my grandma wants me to take it, so I don't know what to do. Like.
Well, unfortunately, Princess, and I'm sorry that you're even on that medication. Well, two things. Number one, I want you to have your auntie or your grandma give me a telephone call because they are your caregivers, so Dr. Umar would need to speak with them about your situation rather than you directly. But what I want you to do is to let them know that you don't want to take the medicine. You've made it clear that you don't believe that you need it, and you should not be taking that medication. But, again, that's a conversation I'm going to need to have with them since you're a child. But this is what you can do. This is what you can do to prove that you don't need that medication. When you go to school in September, I want you to do your best. Get all A's and B's. Never get in trouble. Never be caught off task by the teacher. Never be caught acting out of turn. This is what I tell young people all the time. If you don't get in trouble, if you can behave so well that the teacher can't say anything about what you did, then you have already proven through your own behavior that you don't need the medication. The only way they can force medication is by forcing a justification for that medication. So when they have to complain about you being hyper or they got to complain about you not paying attention, then that gives them the ability to try to push those drugs through your caregivers. So the way you can fight back against that medicine as a child is by going to school and being the best student in that class, by being the most well-behaved student in that class. And then when you go to the meeting with your parents, you can say, look, I don't need this medicine. Prove to me that I need this medicine. Have I gotten suspended? Have I gotten sent to the principal's office? Have I had detention? Has my teacher ever had to talk to me? I haven't done anything that justifies me taking this medication, and auntie and grandma, I don't want these medications because I know that these have side effects in them, and you guys need to talk to Dr. Umar about it. So if you want, Princess, have them get in contact with me, and I would love to talk to them. But what you can do is prove to everybody you don't need the medicine by going to school, doing the very best you can, and by not exemplifying any type of behavior problems. You understand what I'm telling you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when school starts, you do well, you behave yourself, get straight A's and B's, because I don't want them to try to put you in special education either. Okay, make sure the teacher never has to talk to you. Sometimes you ain't going to want to pay attention. Sometimes you're going to be a little tired. Sometimes you're going to feel like acting up. Sometimes you're going to want to be a little bit hyper. But I know that you can control that. I know that you can control it, and you know that you can control it. But the teachers don't think you can. So you got to prove to them that you can. And if you prove to them that you can control yourself, there's no longer a need for them to be talking to anybody about medicating you.
Thank you.
No problem, Princess.
All right, and thank you. And, Doc, that's a perfect way to end our broadcast. We want to. Thank you. Give you the opportunity to make any closing comments that you'd like to make at this time, sir.
Sure. I wanted to put that contact info back out. Folks asked me for it again. So, again, that's drumarjohnson.com, drumarjohnson.com. On Twitter, at Dr. Umar Johnson. Email, drumarjohnson@yahoo.com. Facebook is Dr. Umar Ifatunde.
That's IFATUNDE. You can order my book on the website, drumarjohnson.com. Detroit. I will see you guys Thursday at the Truth Bookstore from 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock, Kansas City. I will see you guys on Sunday the 25th, Chicago. I'll see you Friday, August the 30th at the African Fest, Washington Park. I'll be speaking at 7 o'clock at the Book Pavilion, Delaware, Wilmington. I will see you guys on Saturday, September the 7th in the morning at the Delaware Technical and Community College. That's going to be from 9 to 1. I speak from 11:30 to 12:30, and then I'm going to hit the road and get on up to the Million Youth March. I will also be in New York for the conference that's going to precede the Million Youth March on Thursday the 5th and Friday the 6th. And then San Diego, I will see you guys on Saturday, September the 14th. Los Angeles, I will see you on Sunday and Monday the 15th and 16th. Jackson, Mississippi, I will see you on September 18th, 19th, and 20th. Washington, D.C., I will see you on September 21st and 22nd. Dallas, Texas, I will be at the South Dallas Cultural Center for the Meeting of the Minds, September 27th, 28th, and the 29th. And then October, Boston, Massachusetts, for the Mass Incarceration Conference, Dick Gregory and myself, October 3rd, 4th, as well as the 5th. And then Gary, Indiana, hometown of Michael Jackson. I will be there Saturday, October the 19th. Seattle, Washington, October 25th and 26th. Los Angeles, again, Saturday, November 2nd for the Ebonics Conference at Charles Drew University. You don't want to miss that. And then Tuesday, November 5th, I'll be at the University of California, San Domingo campus. Friday, November 8th, Charlotte, North Carolina. Saturday the 9th, Newberry, South Carolina. Sunday the 10th will be Charleston, South Carolina. Patterson, New Jersey, Saturday, November the 16th for Sisters Only Breakfast. Norfolk, Virginia, November 23rd and 24th. Back over to the United Kingdom, London. I will be with you guys Thursday, November the 28th to December 1st. That's London, England for the family over there. Louisville, Kentucky, December 7th. Philadelphia, December the 14th. And we close out the year in Buffalo, New York, for probably the most powerful Kwanzaa celebration in the country. Dr. Umar will be visiting Buffalo for the first time Friday, December the 27th, Buffalo, New York, Kwanzaa program, 7 o'clock. If you need flyers or information on any of those events, just shoot me an email at drumarjohnson@yahoo.com through the website, or you can text me at area code 215-989-9858. I want to thank the New Black Panther Party and also my brother Sean for bringing me on the show this night. I really enjoyed it. Sure, it won't be the first time. Normally I come on the show once, and next thing you know, we're kicking the door in several times after that. So whenever y'all want to have a brother back, just let me know. I'll make time out of the busy schedule to make that happen, and I'm really, really looking forward to coming to the Million Youth March. In fact, it's the only march I've never been to. I've been to the Million March, Million Man, the Family March, the Million Woman. I've been to all the marches except the Million Youth March. So, you know, it's a personal obligation for me to be there to speak and to share in the day's events. I think it's going to be beautiful. We want all the young people coming, and we want the middle-aged people. We want the elders. We want the children. Bring the whole family with you, not just the youth. It's for everybody, and I'm sure that Attorney Zulu Shabazz would agree with me when I say that it's truly going to be an event for the entire family. So, brothers and sisters, mark your calendars. Saturday, that's September 7th, Harlem, New York. Let's do it real big.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'll be there to join you. When you get to Louisville, I'll be there in Louisville. And, of course, I'll see you there in New York City, Harlem, September the 7th, and that whole week of the convention. My honor. Thank you so much, Doctor, for your time tonight and being on the show with us. We've immensely enjoyed it. Words can't express the hearts that have been touched tonight. And we ask, again, that you remain blessed, safe. We ask the ancestors' blessings with you wherever that you go. And again, as our Supreme Captain told you, that anytime you need us, reach out to us. We got you.
Definitely. Give thanks, bro.
Give thanks. Ashe. Thank you so much. Brothers and sisters, you have been listening to Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. Umar Abdullah Johnson, our brother, warrior, comrade, soldier, friend, and scholar in this mission. And again, make sure you take his contacts, make sure you support him, make sure you go to the website, make sure you buy his book, make sure you keep this brother's movement afloat, make sure you keep him together. When the ancestors and the Creator bless us with brothers and sisters who are willing to organize and stand on the front lines, the people must support by any means. And make sure you're there for the Men Youth March September the 7th, right there in Harlem, New York, 125th Street, Adam Clayton Powell. Make sure you're there for the 5th. For the National Black Family Convention, go to millionyouthmarch2013.com. That's millionyouthmarch2013.com for further information. We thank you so, so much for joining us. And make sure that you replay this broadcast and make sure that you spread it around for people who may have not had a chance to hear this tonight. This is definitely historic. This is definitely classic. This is definitely something for the archives to be played over and over again to pick up the jewels from. On behalf of Dr. and Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz, the National Chairman and the Central Committee of the New Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, we thank you for listening to us tonight, and we ask that you join us again this Wednesday, 8 p.m., for another power-packed edition of Black Power Radio. And remember this, it's black power for black people. It's all power to the people. And remember, if black people are not free, there's nobody that's free. And black power.